This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are listening to the longest-running, weekly, episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the most must-listen podcast on PTB and Pop. Welcome, everyone, to the longest-running, weekly, episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. And you might notice that I didn't have any help on that. Why is that, person on the other line?
Quite frankly, if you're going to use such inspirations as Mike Mizanin for our intro, I'm just going to decline to participate.
Oh, well, that is your prerogative if you don't want to draw inspiration from one of the most successful and greatest villains in the wrestling business today. But
that's your opinion.
For those that may not know, for those of you who may be listening to us for the first time, I am Greg Phillips, the Brian Pillman to my friend here, Nick Dukes, Tom Z-Man Zink.
Are you saying that I'm the more attractive one?
I'm saying that both of us are young.
It sounds to me like you finally just admitted what we've known all along, that I'm the more attractive one.
I thank you for
the compliment, sir, and we move forward.
I believe that Tom Zink and Brian Pillman were both, as Tony Schiavone would describe them, handsome, strapping young men who got along quite well together. Thank you very much.
Allegedly.
Rumor and innuendo, Nick.
I wonder how they got along with Jim Barnett. In any event,
we are here for the first time in what feels like forever, Nick.
2 months. We took 2 months off.
2 months off. Yeah.
For what was it? It was for CW finale, the big special edition we had for that, and then of course Wonder Woman month. So getting back at it for the first time in a while.
But we're out of the gimmick months now, and we're back with another edition of the Hard Travelers for Hire. This is where we, the hard traveling fanboys, take a voyage, a fantastic voyage indeed, through the Marvel Cinematic Universe, movie by movie.
In this case, a pretty okay voyage.
In this case, a super fantastic voyage. A much better than many of the movies we'll review a little bit later on voyage. But
but
nevertheless, we are on a voyage. And today our voyage takes us to that year of all years, that super memorable year, 2013. Now, Nick, where were you in 2013?
I was living here in Columbus, finally. I remember that. I think 2013 was the
You
first
mean there in Columbus, because
that's
we are,
true. That's
to
true.
Remind you, in our L-shaped studio British Columbia.
Vancouver, British Columbia, and all that. So I was living in Columbus, Georgia, for the first full year of our stay in Columbus. And this may have actually been the first big time superhero movie of our tenure in Columbus, if I recall correctly. Could be wrong on that. I don't think I am, because the Avengers came out, you know, May of 2012, and Marvel didn't release another film for the rest of 2012. So I think this was the first big one later that year. So, or excuse me, late the next year in May of 13. And of course, we were all excited. I mean, Avengers had been a massive critical and financial success. I think most longtime comics fans were blown away, and we were all interested to see what the future of the solo Marvel movies would look like after they had kind of opened the proverbial Pandora's box in terms of you know, team up movies.
Certainly, I think that we were all excited. We were coming off the heels, of course, of in 2012, The Avengers, which I would encourage everyone to look that up in the archives if you would. Nick, what are some of your favorite memories of 2013, and why do they all revolve around B.J. Upton?
Was B.J. Upton really on the Braves in 2013? Was it that long ago?
That was the season they signed him, in fact.
Good Lord, man.
To a five-year, $75.25 million contract.
Listen, we all thought it was going to work at the time. I mean, most people thought that was a great signing. So we can't, you know, we can't sit here and cast aspersions upon one Mr. Upton or the other Mr. Upton in hindsight. Although I will say my fondest memory of B.J. Upton isn't anything he actually did on the field, but the sheer overwhelming joy it caused in our good friend Greg Rossino. Just like any time the Braves do anything causes him sheer overwhelming joy.
Yes. Just the other day, I understand that the Braves added a new hot dog stand to their stadium, which led to much jubilation in the Rossino household.
I literally saw a Facebook post on his wall the other day celebrating the fact that the Braves were only 8.5 games out of first place and 2 games under 500. I am not exact. That's a shoot, brother.
They're almost average.
But we are veering way off topic.
The point is that 2013 was 4 years ago, folks. Can you believe it? 4 years ago. And again, we're coming on the heels of The Avengers, which was the big culmination of phase one of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, as you can find in our archives. And that brings us to the third entry in what is the linchpin Marvel franchise, or at least was to that point, and that is Iron Man. We had seen Iron Man 1 launch the MCU back in 2008 to rave reviews. We've seen Iron Man 2, which had more of a mixed reception, but still positive. Both Nick and I think, enjoyed it a little bit more than the general consensus on it, and we ranked it accordingly. And now we come to the third entry. And for this one, Jon Favreau, who directed the first two entries in Iron Man, decided to depart the director's chair. He was, I don't know exactly why. I don't know if you know why, Nick. What have you heard on that? I seem to recall he was feeling a little bit of pressure from the studio. What have you heard on Jon Favreau's decision to leave the directorial position?
I seem to remember the story was that he just had His experience working on Iron Man 2 wasn't nearly as positive as his experience working on Iron Man 1, because with Iron Man 1, the studio didn't really – I mean, they had tentative plans they wanted to attempt if everything went well, but really Favreau was kind of left to his own devices. He, you know, Favreau, Robert Downey Jr., and Kevin Feige all kind of worked together to create the film that wound up being the first Iron Man, whereas by the time Iron Man 2 rolled around, Marvel was pot committed, and Favreau was tasked with not just telling the Iron Man 2 story, but setting up subsequent elements, the introduction of Black Widow, you know, furthering the Tony and his Tony's involvement with S.H.I.E.L.D. angle. And so from what I understand, Favreau just felt increasingly hamstrung by some of the constraints that were being placed upon him. And so he made the decision that he was not going to return for Iron Man 3. But As we'll note here during our review of the film, things were not so contentious that he wasn't involved at all. He did stay on as an executive producer, I believe, and continued to play his role as Tony Stark's longtime bodyguard, Happy Hogan, in the film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that left the film looking for a new director and a new writer, by the way. And what we got was Shane Black, along with Drew Pearce, who was going to join him as the co-screenwriter. But this was, by and large, a Shane Black production. A little bit of background on Shane Black. You could have at least given me a courtesy chuckle there, for God's sake. He is the writer, most notably, arguably, of Lethal Weapon and Lethal Weapon 2, two of the most successful action movies of all time. He's also written and directed written films, rather, such as The Monster Squad, The Last Boy Scout, which has that memorable scene, Nick, you may remember, of of the football player in the movie running down the field and shooting people as they try to tackle him. which at times would be a an acceptable choice for the Miami Dolphins. And Last Action Hero, Long Kiss Goodnight. He also didn't write it, but he played Hawkins in Predator, if you recall. One of the members.
I never noticed that. Wow, okay.
Yep. He was Hawkins in Predator and suffers as everyone in the movie does except for Arnold, he suffers a very violent end. And he made his directorial debut, and this is what the Iron Man connection comes in. Long history of writing great action movies, action comedies being kind of his specialty. But he directed this movie called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in 2005. And we talked about it just a little bit in our Iron Man review back when we started this whole journey. Basically, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang was the comeback for Robert Downey Jr. He had been kind of embarrassed and out of the public eye due to his drug issues. Studios weren't willing to take a chance on him. And by all measures, this is the film that got him on Marvel's radar again for the Iron Man role. And it was a buddy cop movie with him and Val Kilmer, mm-hmm. detective type movie. Really funny, really good. And eventually, long story short, Shane Black ends up in the director's chair for Iron Man 3. Certainly his first venture into the superhero genre as far as a director goes. So how would he do? It's only going to be the second movie that he's directed. He did write it, of course, and it's the first major action, big budget action movie that he's written since The Long Kiss Goodnight. So how is it going to turn out? Well, the one thing that he said about going into this film is, being a third movie, the worst thing to do is to make the same movie as the first two. So he wanted to make a totally different kind of Iron Man movie. He didn't want it to be two guys in a suit fighting each other. He wanted it to be something different. Now, along the way, there was some studio involvement, as we'll discuss a little bit later on. But nevertheless, Nick, what was your familiarity? Obviously, I have a pretty good familiarity with Shane Black. What's your familiarity with Shane Black going into the Iron Man or Iron Man 3 as a project?
Well, you know, I was obviously aware of his work on the Lethal Weapon films and enjoyed that. And then other than that, I didn't actually know that he was involved with any of the other films you mentioned outside of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which I, of course, have seen. And while I probably don't love it as much as you do, I do enjoy it to a great deal. So I was aware of him, but I wasn't, you know, as well-versed as you and some other action aficionados probably are or were at the time.
Here's an interesting bit that I didn't actually know, Nick. Drew Pierce, the co-writer of this movie, mm-hmm. was originally hired by Marvel to mm-hmm. write a script for Runaways.
Yep.
Which is the Brian K. Vaughan
I think I had read that somewhere,
series.
Although I didn't remember it.
Interesting note there of what might have been. So, anyway, Iron Man 3. We come into it. All the major players are returning as far as the cast goes. You've got Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark. They're inseparable in my mind, Nick. You've got Don Cheadle coming back as Rhodey, War Machine, James Rhodes. Gwyneth Paltrow as Pepper Potts. Jon Favreau, you mentioned, as Happy Hogan. And I don't believe that is his real first name, folks, but I could be wrong on that. And, yeah, so those are the main guys coming back. We also get some new additions to the cast. We get Guy Pearce as Aldrich Killian. And with a name like that, there's no chance that he's anything but a villain. Rebecca Hall, the lovely Rebecca Hall, as Maya Hansen, mm-hmm. who has more of a neutral name that you're not really sure what that means. Stephanie Sostak as the simply named Brant, which most likely a villain name because it's one name. James Badge Dale as Savin, who I don't know if he's ever actually called by name in the movie, but nevertheless, he's there. He's a henchman.
Yep.
Ben Kingsley, notably, was advertised and shown in the trailers as playing the Mandarin, who we'll hold off on discussing for just a few minutes. Mandarin is kind of, to give you a little background, briefly now, we'll get into it more later, one of the oldest Iron Man villains, going back to the beginning of the 60s Iron Man run by Stan Lee and company. I don't want to just put it on Stan. And
your subtle shots are already, you're already bringing them. I like it. I like it. Setting the tone, laying the groundwork, telling a story. For God's sake.
Selling.
You are picking a body part and working that body part.
What the hell happened to it, folks? And at this rate, we are going to go to a time limit draw.
At this rate, are we ever going to start the goddamn movie?
No. And then I wanted to bring special mention to Miguel Ferrer, who recently passed away, plays the vice president in this movie. Oh, doesn't appear much, but obviously my love of Miguel Ferrer, however you pronounce his last name, comes from his role as Bobby in RoboCop and one of the great sniveling villains, Bob Morton. Phenomenal. So what we're going to do, folks, if you've got your copy of Iron or Arn Man 3, if you've got it in your DVD player, your Blu-ray player, if you found it on some illegal or legal streaming site, we've got ours paused right now at 00000, all zeros. So we are going to hit play, and we're just going to have it on in the background with subtitles on to kind of spark conversation, remind us of elements, maybe of some dialogue here and there that we've forgotten. We're not going to get through the entire movie, just as a heads up. But you're welcome to watch along with us, and maybe
threatening to do that at some point. So for one of these movies, is one of these movies down the road, we actually will do a feature length one, but not tonight.
No, that's for somebody else, baby.
That's for another movie, baby.
So what we're going to do is I'm going to count us down, and we're going to hit play, and then Nick and I are going to talk about the movie in some random order. So in 3, 2, 1, play.
If I may, I feel it appropriate, Greg, to open our discussion of this film as the movie begins with something of an opening statement. And I would like to make the following opening statement as a disclaimer up front. I just want to go ahead.
Is this a preamble?
I want to go ahead and get this out of the way. The nature of the discussion that you and I are probably about to have is going to be rather contentious at times. Let me say for the record that while Greg is going to attempt to paint my view of the movie as something that it is not, I will say up front, I like this movie. I do like this movie. I would wager I've probably seen it more times than you have at this point. And I find things to like about it. I maintain, as I have said many times throughout our Hard Travelers for Hire series, that I don't believe that Marvel Studios has made a bad movie yet. The movies are just varying degrees of good to great. So I do like this movie. And let me also say, preemptively before we get there, I am not a racist, nor do I support racist caricatures from the 1960s. Despite whatever, you know,
that's not what I've heard.
Despite whatever bullshit politics in the back, my colleague is going to attempt to link me to.
If I may, you've had your chance. Yeah. If I may offer my own preamble, it is appropriate, ladies and gentlemen, that this movie begins in Bern, Switzerland, because that right there was a prime example of riding the fence from my partner. Much like Switzerland, he's trying to wave the beige flag of neutrality, when in fact, all he's doing is covering his ass, because he knows how he feels. I know how he feels.
That's right, Greg. Everything must be the best thing ever or the worst thing ever. It can't just be – there can be no nuance in there.
I'm going to let you all in on a little secret. I know Nick better than he knows himself.
Hey, look here, Greg. Here's something that will become a trend in Guy Pearce's career, him in terrible makeup.
What the hell else is Guy? I don't know Guy Pearce's career. We're not here to talk about his career.
Another film that you love so good, Prometheus, has him in one of the worst makeup jobs of all time.
I don't even remember him in Prometheus. Listen, I liked Prometheus. I didn't like everything about Prometheus. I don't remember him. I don't remember it being good or bad. I mainly remember Fassbender, and I remember the cool visuals, and I remember the ship.
I also like Prometheus, for the record.
No, I've heard you say in your mind that the two worst movies ever made are Iron Man 3 and Prometheus.
Worse than Batman Forever, is that what you're driving at?
Yes, because you've seen them more recently. And as you know, Nick, the internet has taught us when you watch something, it becomes either the best thing you've ever seen or the worst thing you've ever seen.
If this is the worst thing I've ever seen, why have I seen it like 5 times at this point?
Because you want to remind yourself of why it's the worst thing you've ever seen. Okay. Because something else we'll have seen since then that won't be the best thing you've seen then becomes the worst thing you've seen.
Okay.
You follow me? It all makes perfect sense.
You know, I'm probably not going to follow most of whatever you're going to say on this podcast, so why start anywhere else?
For God's sake. Anyway, past his preamble there, we're already well into the opening scene here where we're going into the past. But basically, I mentioned earlier that Shane Black wanted to make a different type of movie than had been made in the Iron Man franchise to that point. And his biggest strengths are writing action, writing quick, fast dialogue between characters, and doing kind of these gritty action-type-oriented movies. So one of his ideas was to have a lot more of Tony Stark outside of the suit in this movie than you got in previous movies. And you do still get a lot of Iron Man, for sure. But right now we're getting a prelude that has that introduces us to some of the key players in the movie. We met a dorky – how would you describe him, Nick? A dorky –
Over-eager.
Over-eager, quirky individual named Aldrich Killian, who will, of course, become our villain in the film. And this is kind of done to set the stage. And Tony's setting it up with narration at the beginning that – the theme of the movie is mistakes from his past coming back to haunt him. And in this case, it was Tony back in his days of being a selfish playboy who didn't really care about anyone but himself, and the emotional scars that he leaves on people, and the domino effect that plays out over the next decade plus. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right now, there is a robot with a dunce cap on. Going across here, which somewhat was reminiscent of Rocky IV to me. I don't know if that was the intent.
Well, no, it was just playing off the recurring gag of the robot, you know, screwing up and Tony berating it from the first two movies.
And it happens many times throughout Tony's scientific career. His devices don't tend to necessarily work on first attempts. But nevertheless,
The closed captions just revealed to me that Tony, instead of calling it dummy, is actually calling it dumb-e, all in caps, as if it's some sort of acronym.
It's a playoff of Wally.
I guess. I don't know.
No, it is. Wally came out like the year before this, right?
Well, no, dummy. He called it dummy in the first film. Like this robot has existed in the first two films.
Oh no, Wall-E came out in 2008, and in 2008,
Iron Man also came out.
Right, but was this not a reference to Wall-E then?
I don't know. That's what I'm just saying that I found it interesting.
Well, I think that I'm taking it as that's what it is.
Here's something you can talk about, Greg. Being the more of the Shane Black aficionado that you are. Has he ever made a movie that isn't set at Christmas time?
Oh, God, I don't know. I mean...
No, seriously, isn't that like one of his recurring things, is that pretty much all the movies he's involved with are set at Christmas time?
I don't remember. I mean, I don't remember. I remember the setting of Lethal Weapon 1. I don't remember the time setting of Lethal Weapon 2. I don't remember the time setting of Long Kiss Goodnight. It's been a long time since I've seen some of these movies. I watched recently.
But I believe I read that somewhere that he works Christmas into pretty much all his films.
He likes it. And I, you know, it's funny you mentioned that, Nick, because I had forgotten until I watched it this time that this movie takes place at Christmas.
Yeah.
And it's framed around Christmas. So technically, it could be considered a Christmas movie.
Technically, I suppose.
I mean, hell, we're counting Die Hard. Everybody counts Die Hard now.
Yeah, I would argue that Christmas plays a more active role in the story of Die Hard than it does here.
But he does buy a giant bear with boobs in this.
Is it a bear or a rabbit? We're getting ahead of ourselves.
Getting ahead of ourselves. In any event, the plot of this movie is loosely based around one of the most – well, let's be honest, one of the few famous Iron Man stories from the comics, which is called Extremis, mm-hmm. written by Warren Ellis, I believe, Nick. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, Warren Ellis and art from Addy Granov.
And what this story is essentially about is these characters we met at the beginning, Killian and Maya Hansen, who's played by Rebecca Hall, are developing, they're scientists, and they're developing this this product. In Killian's case, he's actually setting up this organization called Advanced Idea Mechanics, or AIM, which anybody that knows Marvel Comics knows that AIM is one of the big villainous groups in Marvel. How would you describe AIM to someone trying to figure out what the hell AIM is, Nick?
I would describe them as beekeepers in yellow costumes is how I would describe them, but that's just me. Because in the comics, Greg, remember they always had the beekeeper hood?
That's true. Yes, I do remember that. Yep.
That's another – here's strike one against this film. All the damn AIM people in it and not one beekeeper costume, Greg.
Not one beekeeper costume. And there's no MODOK to give them orders.
Oh, now you're just tickling my fancy. Bye.
Bye. MODOK, who is – I'm not even going to get into that. But AIM in the movie is essentially arms dealers. But they're a more advanced version kind of what Justin Hammer was trying to do with Hammer Industries in Iron Man 2. They're worldwide
more
and they're –
more secretive, like a think tank. They're described as a think tank geared towards developing new weapons and concepts for the future fight, so to speak.
Absolutely. They're not interested in being publicly recognized. They're just interested in the power from behind the scenes. And Rebecca Hall – go ahead.
Not to throw you off too much, but you know, for the first time on screen here as we're watching the film, we just got a little bit of our first peek at Ben Kingsley's interpretation of the Mandarin, which if you couldn't – as you can't see, it's on video. I did the air quotes when I said the Mandarin. So – Greg, I know you on this rewatch mentioned you kind of dug those bits.
Yes, they're clearly, at least to me, influenced by the way they're shot by the Dark Knight scenes with the Joker interrogating the police officers and also Anthony Michael Hall. You know, the hand cam footage. It kind of evoked that to me, and I dug it. I dug the intrigue, the sense of menace. Not anything out of the blue original or anything, but it was a valid take. It was an acceptable take on a villainous character, and I kind of liked how they were blending elements of different cultures. It wasn't just one culture being represented by this Mandarin. It was basically all these different cultures that have the unifying theme of not liking America and not liking Western civilization very much. So he combines elements. They even reference elements of Chinese culture, of Middle Eastern culture, of Russia, of a lot of different regimes, a lot of different thought processes and beliefs, and it references attacks from America and all these different countries. So it provides, seemingly anyway, a motivation for this evil character of the Mandarin. pretty funny. Pretty funny exchange there. But we'll get to this. This is one of the strengths of the movie, I think. One of the many strengths, in my opinion. But one of the strengths of the movie is the buddy cop relationship of sorts. Not even though they're not cops, but the buddy relationship between Tony Stark and James Rhodes.
No,
is great.
Absolutely. The relationship between these two characters is great when it's on the screen. I would argue, however, it's not on the screen nearly enough.
I am impressed that a kid that young knows what a wormhole is. I didn't at that age.
In this universe, it was probably played on the news media, the liberal mainstream media, nonstop. So he probably saw coverage of it and whatnot.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that. But anyway, back to what I was saying before I was interrupted. The basic plot of the movie is about extremists. AIM is a group that aims to control things from behind the scenes. Rebecca Hall's character of Maya Hansen is a scientist who was developing this extremist thing that was going to help the human body heal, basically unlocking natural recuperative abilities. Well, over time, as we learn in the film, Maya and Aldrich Killian – who both get burned by Tony at the same time, by the way. Tony ups and leaves Maya after their one-night stand in Switzerland. He leaves Aldrich Killian on the roof after tricking him to go up there, just to be a dick, honestly. And this comes back to haunt Tony, because over this time, Maya and Killian, unbeknownst to viewers and unbeknownst to Tony, have worked together to develop Extremis, but it's not quite as successful as they'd hoped. They're trying to use it and turn it into a something a little bit different than what they initially envisioned, because initially it was envisioned to heal people. Now they want to use it not only to heal people, but to enhance them and weaponize them. And they have been doing this over time, and that kind of sets up the conflict in the film as this AIM organization is doing its thing behind the scenes. Meanwhile, the Mandarin is launching attacks around the globe at prospects, but primarily in America, at various sensitive locations. They're going after, you know, I think there's a church bombing. There's like there's all kinds of stuff going on from the Mandarin and his organization. And that's the primary conflict. Who is the Mandarin? Why is he doing this? What is Killian's game? Simultaneously, we've got the subplots going on of Tony and Pepper's relationship and the continued stress on that caused by Tony's anxiety attacks that he's having, which leads to the other kind of tied into subplot of PTSD right now being suffered by Tony Stark as a result of the events in The Avengers. If you recall, Tony goes into the wormhole we just referenced to sacrifice himself to save the Earth and falls down and somehow survives. But the experience leaves him changed and he can't forget about it. He hyperventilates. He has random bouts of anxiety. It plays out over the course of the film and doesn't really get resolution, which is, I think, a really good touch, because this kind of thing usually doesn't get resolution. So all of that being said, you've got these subplots going on. I think those are the two major subplots that I mentioned, and there may be something else I've forgotten. But and then you've got the main plot going on of what is going on with the Mandarin. When we look at this compared to the plots of or the stories of Iron Man 1 and Iron Man 2, certainly different. Certainly a different take on what's going on. It seems at times like it's actually a more serious movie than the first two, although it plays out to not necessarily be that way.
Yeah, I wouldn't agree. I would not agree with that assessment personally about the seriousness of the movie.
Well, you've got literal terrorist attacks and you've got PTSD. I think that instantly raises it above rich guy has problems.
Absolutely. And if you it would do that, Greg, if you actually took the time to explore any of these things rather than undercutting the drama with a joke every 30 seconds.
Oh, no. Listen, I'm not making the argument that it – you totally are already misinterpreting what I'm saying. I did not say it is a more serious movie.
You would think. I said, okay, fair enough. Yeah.
Right.
Right. On the surface.
So testy, Nick. You're so
on
testy.
On the surface. Fair enough.
You're so testy already. So – but instead, the direction that Shane Black goes in, because to me, that wouldn't really fit an Iron Man movie. Instead, he ramps up the comedy and turns this into a movie that goes back and forth between some great moments of levity and comedy and great dialogue, but it never loses that sense of stakes. There's stakes throughout the movie. And unlike you, what works for me with the movie is I felt the stakes. I felt genuine panic when Pepper in the closing sequence, when Pepper is endangered. I feel the claustrophobia of his PTSD, which is something our friend Glenn Butler has talked about. One of the reasons he enjoyed this movie was the very interesting way that it handles the concepts of anxiety and PTSD, and the way that it doesn't have any simple explanations for them, the way that it displays them in an accurate manner, as opposed to what we see sometimes in movies where it's people just grabbing a bottle and downing it every 2 seconds. You know, it's a little bit more nuanced and layered than that in this movie. And I appreciate that subplot in particular because they don't go the cliched route. They don't go the easy route. And it doesn't – you don't have any warning of when it's coming. It strikes – it hits him at the most inopportune moments when you're kind of have pushed it out of your mind that this is even a thing, and suddenly he gets hit by a panic attack. And it's not a convenient plot. It's not a linear thing. It's just there, and it's omnipresent, and it never goes away. Oh, your thoughts, Nick?
I would disagree with that assessment of that. I like the idea of PTSD, and in theory, you know, introducing it to this film would be well done. And I actually think the first scene that we saw a little bit ago with the bar, you know, where they were at the sports bar or whatever, when he runs out and runs into the suit to have a diagnostic check, that actually is a really well done scene. I like that scene. However, I would argue that every time it happens in the film after that, rather than attempting to truly use it to show Tony's mental state, they play it for laughs. And that is not – it winds up being an element of the film, especially on this rewatch, that bugged me a little bit more than the first few times I saw it.
See, I very much disagree with that. I don't think his anxiety is played for laughs at all.
You don't think the kid antagonizing him in the little town is meant to be funny?
No.
You don't think that's meant to be funny?
No. I think,
then what's that meant to be?
No. Listen, I think the kid is meant to be funny. I think Tony is not. You're laughing. There's a difference. You can have nuance in a scene, Nick. It doesn't have to be either a funny scene or not a funny scene. It's the humor. Yes, you're supposed to think, oh, the kid's being annoying here, and it's somewhat funny. But you're not supposed to laugh at the fact.
Good Lord. Sorry. The cans on the giant stuffed creature. Just
it's well endowed.
It has blessings. I bet it has perfect teeth, too.
Blessings from the gods, right?
From the patrons.
The patrons.
Yeah. Oh, anyway, sorry.
There's a lot of plastic surgeons in L.A. Wouldn't
these be cotton surgeons in this case?
God, what the hell were we talking about?
We were talking about we're disagreeing on the use of the PTSD in the film.
Oh yes, so I think the kid was supposed to be funny, but I don't think you're ever supposed to laugh at Tony having an anxiety attack in this movie. I don't think that was ever played. I think it was played as this guy has got a serious problem, and this is a guy who laughs at. This is a guy whose way out of everything is joking, and this is something he can't joke his way out of.
Right, like, and I think, again, the theory and the idea, the concept is one I really like. It's just I think in execution, it kind of undercuts the drama of those scenes to me. Like it takes it – it still works. Like I said, I mean there most things in this film work for me. It still works, but it doesn't work nearly to the degree that it could have or probably should have in my opinion.
That's fair enough. We'll have to agree to disagree on that one, as we will a few times throughout this broadcast, I'm certain. Mm-hmm. Which is just a precursor to us calling each other Satan incarnate by the end. What an odd design on those pipes in the background.
Pipes in the background?
Yeah, look when it switches viewpoints back to time. It's a weird observation. Oh, damn it, they're not showing it now. There's like L-shaped pipes in the house.
Well,
not unlike.
They clearly took inspiration from the plans we were drawing up at the time.
For our
L-shaped studios, yeah.
Exactly. It seems like one of those houses that has intricate designs for the sake of having intricate designs.
I also noticed that like his workshop here doesn't really look like the workshop from the first two films.
I think, yeah, he's clearly added on to it. I think
I don't remember the window onto the coast being there. It looks like he's kind of redesigned the entire thing. It doesn't feel as cavernous as his workshop from the first two films.
It feels like – well, I think that's one of the things that they are focusing on with – I guess I should have mentioned that because I totally forgot to mention that other aspect. As part of Tony's struggling to deal with the events of New York and the Avengers – he has basically been going overdrive in building stuff. What is up to Mark 42?
Yeah,
on
42
the,
was the most recent one, I believe. Yeah,
on the Iron Man suits. He's built all these new suits. He's clearly redesigned his home, added on to it. He's spending all of his time doing this stuff. And what we just saw in the movie as we're watching it here is almost a Dr. Manhattan like situation, Nick. Where
yeah.
Tony has sent a proxy in the form of an Iron Man suit to woo his girlfriend Pepper Potts while he stays downstairs and works. Not the best move to do with your girlfriend, as Dr. Manhattan found out as well.
If only there had been three Iron Man suits attempting to, quote, woo Pepper at one time.
Flair hit it first.
No hair, no flair. Good Lord, I can't believe I said that. Anyway, let's move on.
Woo! So,
oh, his big fucking beak.
So, and here you see, as Tony's anxiety is getting the best of him again, and his suit
I actually really did like this bit with the suit, like, kind of being controlled by Tony's subconscious, and it kind of comes up to Pepper in the night. I thought that was a cool little touch there.
Yes. That's something we should mention. One of the things that this movie does is give Pepper Potts a more active role than she's had in the first two movies.
Absolutely.
In terms of she plays a bigger part in the narrative, in the structure. We'll get to the ending in a little bit here, but she...
Yeah, she's kind of gradually stepped up her role across the three films, like from the, you know, very much a supporting role in the first to almost like a... if there was anything between a supporting role and a co-lead in the second to a full-on co-lead here in the third. Like, not nearly as much screen time as RDJ or some of the principals, but as integral to the plot as anybody else in the film.
Mm-hmm. And as a result, I feel like the Tony Stark and Pepper Potts relationship is more believable. And we talked about this in the Iron Man 2 review as well. Their chemistry and their dynamic is just more believable than any of the other MCU relationships we've seen to this point. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But I would also say that's probably not, again, I think as we've discussed before, not exactly saying a whole hell of a lot.
Oh, certainly.
I think the one film of we got of it, of Captain America and Peggy Carter, was pretty good. And other than that, I'm struggling to come up with a relationship that's been really, really believable in the MCU. We haven't gotten there yet, but in a couple months when we discuss Guardians, I think the Quill and Gamora thing...
Yeah, it's probably the only one that... Yeah,
but they're definitely slow playing that a lot more than they are here in these Iron Man films.
One day he'll get to first base.
One day.
But,
and discover that Flair was there first.
Flair was there first. Big man, it happened 25 years ago. I'll never forget it. But getting off of 80s wrestlers and their love for carpeted floors, let us move to a more family friendly topic, and let's talk about
hundreds of people being incinerated
by these exploding extremists. People, injected people. And that's something that I guess we should talk about next. Extremis.
Yeah.
I've never read Extremis, the comic book. I'd have no familiarity with it, but I know the general premise of it, and I know that it's different from what we get here in the execution of these extremist concepts. In the movie, Extremis basically inflames. What is the word I'm looking for, Nick? It charges people with this kinetic energy, not unlike Gambit charging his cards. And so it will heal their body parts, but it also makes them unstable. And they have the ability to burn things and shoot fire-like things at people. However, at times they're so unstable that they explode. And when they explode, it's like a bomb going off. It's like a
– almost like – well, even worse than a bomb, almost like an unnaturally high heat signature that it gives off, to the point where later on in the film, that's one of the ways Tony attracts the use of Extremis, is by looking at instances of explosions where there was an abnormally high heat signature involved. So
yes.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I will say. I've only read Extremis once, and it's been a long time. But one of the things that bugged me about the movie, even when I first saw it, and still kind of bugs me today, is my memory of Extremis is that it kind of affected each person who was infected with it differently. So you kind of had, throughout the story, these various characters who each presented their own unique threat to Tony. And I think here in the film, by having it all kind of work the same, like, for example, I don't understand, and I don't think they do a good enough job of explaining why one person with Extremis is any more dangerous to Tony than any other person with Extremis, if that makes any sense. Like, for example, why is Aldrich Killian, infected with Extremis, so much more difficult for him to take down than any of the other people he's come into contact with throughout the film?
Right. Yes, that's a that is a good point, and that's why I wanted to introduce that topic, because that's something I don't have any base with the comics, but I will say that it would have been cooler, I think, to have more variety in the extremis effects. Like, in other words,
even if you wanted to maintain the heat based portion of it, but have like different doses, granting people different abilities or whatnot. The way it works in here, I think we see three different, well, technically four different users of extremis throughout the film, and it all seems to kind of work exactly the same way, which is it leads to a feeling of sameness after a while, in my opinion, anyway.
Right, I can agree with that. To address your concerns, though, you brought up a concern about why does it affect Killian differently. They actually address that in the movie. Later on in the film, when Maya Hansen is being when they've got Tony held captive, and Maya is there, and she's trying to convince Killian to let Tony go, she's threatening to kill herself.
That's
and
right.
The whole reason that Killian is upset that she will kill herself is Maya has been, and she says, "Who's going to be there to help you when you're on the verge of going overboard?" Referring to blowing up, basically, right. and you know, he kills her with the thought that Tony can take her place, which doesn't turn out to be the case, obviously, but the extremist thing, yeah, I agree. There could have been more variety in terms of what the abilities were, or at least how they manifested, maybe, like you said.
Yeah.
That would have been nice to see. That is a bone that I will throw your way and will admit that's a good point. So moving along from extremis as a concept, let's talk about the principle.
What a dick move from Tony, by the way.
Oh, I know. That is beginning the current assault on the media that we have today. I mean,
you can draw a direct line between Tony Stark and Donald Trump. That's the deal.
That's what I'm getting at. Yep. And
always dug these bits throughout all three films. Anytime they do the virtual recreation of anything where he's like walking around the room and manipulating it at the same time, always dug these bits. They're simple, but it's an aspect of the films I always enjoyed every time they did them.
And while he's doing this, he's actually laying out these disparate things about the Mandarin that don't make sense.
Right.
The fact that he uses Chinese philosophy but sounds like a Baptist preacher. You know, he doesn't really have any depth to what he's saying, really. And it's laying out these things that maybe the Mandarin isn't necessarily what we think he is. These are the first hints of that. Although at the time, the first time you see this movie, you don't realize that. You don't think – you just think, wow, this is just this crazy, you know, hodgepodge. Dare I say it, Nick, Danny hodgepodge character of these different backgrounds.
Yes, absolutely. One could even make the argument that if they had, you know, wanted to go with that interpretation of the character who perhaps was, you know, bringing in these different philosophies into one belief structure, it might even make sense to tie it into the very idea of the Ten Rings. Perhaps the rings could signify different cultures that they had appropriated bits of wisdom from, rather than alien rings of power or whatnot.
Perhaps if he said a magical word. And a wizard, an old wizard, granted him the abilities of ancient gods of different cultures.
I wish he would say a magic word and be granted that wizard's beard, because that beard's awesome.
It's a pretty nice beard, isn't it?
Yep.
It's a good beard. So let's talk a little bit about some of the cast in this movie. Obviously, we have Robert Downey Jr. returning as Tony Stark. We don't really, I don't think, need to talk about him anymore. He's one of the ultimate.
He's it, you know. I mean,
he's the guy. You know, he's the reason you go to see these movies.
That's they won.
The reason you keep coming back. You know, we even talked about him in the Avengers movie of how he's the glue that keeps the whole thing together. So we don't really need to focus on him. We do get Don Cheadle in his second turn as James Rhodes, which to me is even better than it was in Iron Man 2. I feel like he's grown more comfortable with each.
I would agree that I think what's here is better, but I feel like he had a more active role in Iron Man 2, and I feel like we got more screen time from him in Iron Man 2. And as a result, you know, while I would agree that when he's here, the performance is probably a little bit better, I think I kind of prefer him in Iron Man 2 just because there's more of him, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can agree that he probably is present a little bit more in Iron Man 2 because this is more of a personal movie for Tony, I think, than 2 was in some ways. But I will also say that I think his performance got better. It becomes more natural. And you really start to, in this movie, for me anyway, view that character and Don Cheadle as one, which we both talked about how much good lord that those breasts on that creature.
What is it? I want to know, damn it.
I don't know. But the, you know, we both talked about how we preferred him to Terrence Howard from the first Iron Man movie. And I think that in this movie, now that you're two movies in, you start to kind of view that character and that actor as one and the same.
I agree with that.
So I really enjoyed his work in this film. And particularly, I feel like his dynamic with RDJ is developed in such a way that it couldn't have worked with Terrence Howard the same way. What are your thoughts on that? Do you disagree?
No, we have earned the ire of a mutual friend of ours by long preferring the Don Cheadle roadie to the Terrence Howard roadie, and nothing happens here that would make me back off of that at all. Although I would say it's not really until Civil War that I really started to fall in love with him as a character the way you did. I kind of really dug everything he did in that film. It was kind of a slow progression from liking him in Iron Man 2 to really liking him here to just, you know, kind of being blown away by him in Civil War. But that's for another time, Daddy.
Yeah, we don't want to tell too many tales out of skewl. And it should also be noted that we earned our friend's enmity for preferring Eddie Guerrero to Chavo Guerrero. So that's another one for the list.
Ooh, we are turning up the passive aggressiveness on the passive aggression, I guess you could say, on this episode, and I like it.
There, that is. There's a little bit of a reference to another thing that we watch a lot. So that's that. Pepper Potts, what do you think of Gwyneth Paltrow's job as Pepper Potts in this film?
Clearly her best performance is Pepper Potts to date in any of the three solo Iron Man movies. As I said before, her role has kind of slowly expanded. And while Iron Man 2 did give her an expanded role, I would argue she's less naggy when it comes to Tony than she, you know, here. And thus you get to see more of an actual, genuine, loving relationship between the two rather than, you know, the playful tension that they do in Iron Man 2. And I kind of like it when they show, you know, how you move past that playful tension into an actual relationship and how it possibly works. So, I think clearly her best performance in an Iron Man film to date.
And you get to see her be stronger and more independent. You just saw her in an Iron Man costume, and she takes the initiative to save herself and Maya. And, you know, later on in the film, you get to see her be even more assertive and influential in the outcome of the movie because she's ultimately the hero of the film. She's the one that saves the day and saves Tony's ass from the proverbial and literal fire as he's fighting these extremist agents and Aldrich Killian. She gets the last blow in on Killian. She's the one that saves the day, puts AIM out of its misery, seemingly. So really good progression for Pepper's character here. And the argument could be made, Nick, and we haven't talked about Maya yet. We'll get to her in a little bit and the kind of interesting backstory behind that character. But as far as Pepper goes, it really feels like this is one of the more progressive Marvel movies in terms of its portrayal of a female, because this is the only Marvel movie to this point where a woman has been able to step up and be the aggressor and be the alpha in the climactic battle scene. Like the Avengers movies and other movies typically end with either Iron Man or Captain America getting the big moment at the end. And here you see not even a superhero, but just a normal person getting the the main event slot.
Well, so I wouldn't go so far as a normal person, you know, as we'll discuss, I'm sure, during the climactic action scene of the film, you know, Pepper is far from normal at that point.
At that point, right.
Yeah, right. But I would, you know, I would agree that it's very interesting they put her in such a role. Kind of similar to the way, although I would say Iron Man 2, while it wasn't the climactic action scene, Black Widow had a very, very key role in that kind of climactic series of scenes. So,
sure, but it's clearly in a supporting role that doesn't, you know, you're not going to have, there's no chance that Black Widow is going to be the one to knock out Whiplash or, you know, whoever the villain in the scene may be at a time. I'm pretty sure that was Whiplash that was the bad guy at the climactic scene there, but maybe not. Who knows? But yes, so she does a great job in this one. Let's talk about our two big new additions to the film, which are Aldrich Killian, who we're going to address first. The first time I saw this movie, I thought Killian was probably the weak link for me because I love this movie, as we have discussed already. I'm a big fan of this one. But Killian, I thought, was another example of kind of a generic Iron Man villain. I put Killian, for me, along the lines of Obadiah Stane, who we went over in the first Iron Man movie. You love that character. I did not like that character.
Love is a strong term. I like him. I like him a great deal. I would say I prefer Stane to Killian, honestly. But I would say I come down on Killian in this film. We discussed this off air a little while ago. I think Killian is almost like a perfect representation of my views on this film as a whole. I like it. I like what Guy Pearce does, but he is not given the best of material, and so I ultimately come down on the side of I like it, but I don't love it by any stretch of the imagination.
Right, and what I found is while in the theater and the first couple times I saw this, I didn't think much of Killian. On this most recent rewatch, I liked him more. Now I do think he gets less interesting as the movie progresses, if that makes sense. Like I think Killian to me is interesting all the way up until the point where he becomes a supervillain.
Right.
And at that point, he's no longer interesting.
And see, to me, I understand the story they were trying to tell with Killian, but as we'll discuss, and I don't know when you want to get into it, I think the version of that story would have been much more interesting with a different character in that role.
Totally agreed, Nick. I think that's a problem with a lot of Marvel movies that we're seeing, and we haven't quite seen enough of them in this journey to make this point overall yet, but this is where you start to see that recurring pattern of Marvel villains that maybe are interesting ideas for a character that don't actually turn into interesting characters, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I think that's fair to say. But I do like him. I did like him more on this watch than I did in previous watches. I think I appreciate a little bit more of what he did and a little bit more of the motivation of his character. I think I got a little bit more this time beyond just being spurned by Tony. It was a kind of a lifetime of being spurned by people and being kind of the forgotten person. And I also like the fact that he looks like a mid-80s member of the Horsemen with his mullet and his suits and his beard. I mean, could you not see this guy cutting a promo next to Tully Blanchard and Arn Anderson back in the day?
Yeah, I guess I could see that. But, you know, ultimately, I would say my opinion of Pierce has kind of stayed consistent throughout my rewatches of this film. You know, I rewatched it yesterday and, again, it's fine, but it's nothing to write home about. It's kind of, as you said, a little bit too atypical of most of the Marvel villains in that regard.
Sure, yeah, and I can agree with that for sure. So let's move on to Rebecca Hall's character of Maya Hansen, who is definitely of the villainous characters in this movie, which encompass Killian and his henchmen, and Maya and the Mandarin. She is the most complex of these characters.
And thus, because the most interesting.
Yes, absolutely.
Despite the fact that she's only in, I think, literally like 5 scenes in the film.
And this is, to be honest, I think this is the first movie I had ever seen her in, but she does a really good job.
No, it's not.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
What else has she been in?
The Prestige.
I don't remember her in the. Who was she in the Prestige?
She played. Oh damn it! The not Scarlett Johansson female love interest.
Oh,
in the Prestige.
Okay, yeah. I gotcha. Yeah, great movie, by the way. Yeah, but it's not a comic book movie, so we can't talk about it here.
But it's fucking awesome, nonetheless.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah, it's a great movie. Holds up really well. Yes, but Rebecca Hall.
Rebecca Hall as Sarah Borden.
Yes, that's I remember now. But I didn't know her much at the time, and I don't think I even put it together that that was the same person. But she does a great job of portraying this strong, independent, divided, sensitive, all of these conflicting emotions person, and it's quite interesting to watch because you see her in the beginning as basically a younger woman with a crush on Tony Stark who gets seduced by him and then burned. You see her passion and her anger, how that motivates her, but she's not solely motivated by that. She's still clearly motivated by genuine desire for knowledge and scientific growth. And she ends up befriending Tony, coming back into his life to kind of set him up for this big grand scheme for AIM. But it also becomes clear that she's not 100% bought in to the big scheme for AIM. Now, here's where it gets interesting from a behind-the-scenes perspective. According to Shane Black, who has gone on record as recently as last year when he was promoting his movie The Nice Guys, Shane Black says that the original plan as he laid it out was that Maya Hansen was going to be the big bad of the movie. She was going to end up being – it was going to be a shocking reveal that she was going to be, you know, the ultimate villain. And I'm going to read a quote actually from an interview that he did with UpRocks about this. He says – the plot went this way and that way. Stephanie Sozdak's character was bigger at one point. We reduced it. Rebecca Hall's character was bigger at one point, and we reduced it. And the interviewer asks why Rebecca Hall's character does have an abrupt ending. And he says, all I'll say is this on the record. There was an early draft of Iron Man 3 where we had an inkling of a problem, which is that we had a female character who was the primary villain in the draft. We had finished the script, and we were given a no-holds-barred memo saying that that cannot stand, and we've changed our minds because, after consulting, we've decided that toy won't sell as well if it's a female. So we had to change the entire script because of toy making. Now, that's not Kevin Feige. That's Marvel Corporate. But now you don't have that problem anymore. And that's referring to Ike Perlmutter being gone, apparently. He said, in the earlier draft, the woman was essentially Killian, and they didn't want a female Killian, they wanted a male Killian. I like the idea, like Remington Steele, you think it's a man, but at the end, the woman has been running the whole show. They just flat out said, no way. So, Nick, what are your thoughts when you hear that?
Frustration, I suppose, because while Aldrich Killian is definitely involved in the opening sequence, to me, that being used as a framing sequence for the entire film kind of doesn't really work unless Maya Hansen is the main driver of the plot from an antagonistic standpoint. The rest of the movie holds together from a plot standpoint pretty well, but I would argue that first scene is really hurt by that revelation because, in hindsight, the entire scene is focused almost entirely on Tony and Maya and it has these two characters locked in a room together. And how much more interesting would it have been had that been the catalyst for those two coming face to face, you know, all those years later?
Yeah. And I think that's certainly fair to compare it to. I was fine with how it played out for the most part, except man, her ending is so abrupt. I do agree with that. Like she gets flat out killed very, very quickly at the end when, doesn't even really get a chance to make a heroic redemptive stand. But I love the idea of her as the main villain. And I agree, Nick. I think it actually makes more sense that way. And how great would it have been, like Shane Black suggested, for it to have been a double puppet situation where Killian is pulling the strings of the Mandarin, but it's actually Maya that is pulling the strings of Killian. You know, that to me would have been even a better swerve than what we got, which is we'll get to the swerve in a little bit, but I'm on record as loving the swerve in this movie, but I think that swerve would have been even over what we got. And how many times, Nick, are we going to have to watch comic book properties get not ruined, but get damaged in some way or altered in some way because of freaking toy sales?
Too many times, unfortunately, you know. Let us not forget that we still don't have our Green Lantern in the animated series because of toy freaking fucking toy sales. Batman Forever and Batman and Robin can largely be blamed on the fact that the Batman Returns toys didn't sell as well. So,
Young Justice.
You know, I don't know. I can't imagine that the Dark Knight toys, you know, sold gangbusters or anything, and yet they didn't stop the studio from greenlighting those, but that's another topic for another time, I suppose.
Well, quite frankly. Nevertheless, it's a thing that happens, so we have to live with the movie as is. I thought Rebecca Hall did a great job in this movie, though. What were your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. When she's here, she's great, and she's really intriguing. I think there's an aura of mystery around her character. You kind of can't really tell what's going on with her at any given moment. You know, it's hard to say that she was one of the more interesting characters of the movie just because, again, she's in it so little. But when she's there, she's captivating, in my opinion.
I would tend to agree with that. What would Klondike Bill think of her? Good point. We better not touch that. I think we've touched on Maya. Let's move on to probably what will be one of our two biggest arguments, folks, are yet to come, I think, on this movie. We've had a lot of mostly common ground, some disagreements here and there about, you know, various aspects of the film. But one of them, and I feel pretty firm in my belief in this, but I'm going to let you go and give your – say your piece on this character. Ty Simpkins portrays Harley Keener.
Fuck's sake.
The boy who – one of the other subplots in this movie is Tony finds himself in Tennessee without his – suit, trying to find out who the Mandarin is, and he befriends a boy, a young boy named Harley Keener, and I'm just going to let Nick touch this one, because I will just say I am going to firmly disagree with Nick on this. I thought the kid was really good. I thought Ty Simpkins did a good job, but I'm going to let Nick say his piece.
Fuck this kid. Fuck this stupid kid. He's annoying in every fucking scene he's in. And yes, I understand the character is meant to be annoying, but why would you write a character into the film that you're supposed to feel sorry for if his entire fucking point is to be annoying? Fuck this kid. Fuck all of us. This is where the movie grinds to a halt for me. This whole Tennessee sequence has, like, it has the interesting fight with him and the redheaded chick, but all the other bullshit with him dragging the suit through the snow and talking to this stupid fucking kid and here playing the PTSD attack for laughs with the kid coming up and peppering him with questions. Fuck this kid.
Oh, I love it.
And for the record, he's not good in Jurassic World either. Fuck this kid.
Let it be said, folks, that he'll accuse this of being a false accusation. Nick Duke hates child actors.
That's not true.
He just does.
It's not true.
He does. He hates child. The only child.
I hate bad child actors.
The only child actor.
The only child actor. Here we go.
That's
not true. It's not true.
Mayor. What are some other child actors you've enjoyed?
I'll tell you. I'm glad you asked.
Shitty-ass Home Alone kid?
There it is. I knew you were going to say it. See, that's your one. My Ty Simpkins is your Macaulay Culkin, sir.
Macaulay Culkin. You just don't like child actors. You always whine about child actors, whether it's Carl in The Walking Dead.
I don't like shitty child actors, Greg. I like good child actors.
There's nothing shitty about Carl on The Walking Dead or Ty Simpkins.
I will acknowledge that Chandler Riggs does a pretty good job. It is the character of Carl that I just can't stand. It has very little to do with Chandler Riggs outside of his stupid fucking haircut. But that's
let me think of some other child actors you've complained about.
Jake Lloyd?
Jake Lloyd. Well, yeah, Jake Lloyd.
Doesn't everyone complain about Jake Lloyd?
Sure. But it's not just Jake Lloyd. I'm trying to think of movies that have kids in them now, and I'm drawing a damn blank at the moment, but you've always bitched about child actors. Every time I talk to you,
Greg, most of them aren't good. Would you agree or disagree? Would you at least agree that it is extremely difficult in most cases to find good child actors?
I would agree with that, certainly. I would 100%.
And thus, by proxy, most of them are really bad.
My dad.
Oh, God.
Does it take away from the movie at all? No.
No, but it doesn't add to the movie either, and I can criticize it for that.
But this is not – Ty Simpkins does a fine job in this movie. He's
in your opinion.
I watched it with a critical eye because you mentioned that to me off the air. I was like, let me watch his performance and see what he could do better. And there's nothing. I'm watching it, and I'm like, he's playing a kid. And he does a good, convincing job. It's the worst kind of child actor to me is the child actor who doesn't act like a kid, who plays a kid that is – but he's like an adult playing a kid, if that makes sense.
Okay, then let me amend then. Fuck the idea of this kid in this script. How about that?
Oh, for God's sake.
Is that better?
Sure.
Does that make me happier?
Absolutely. At least I know you're not biased against child actors.
Love of God.
For the record, ladies and gentlemen, I actually do agree with Nick's point that in general, that most child actors are bad.
Most of them are really, really bad. Hey, I'll throw you one, and it's on a show we both hate. I think the kid who plays young Bruce on Gotham is, for the most part, pretty good.
That's a tough one. We'll see. I mean, it's kind of back and forth for me. It's hard to judge because his material is so bad.
It's awful. But he does the best he could possibly do with such shitty material.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Same could probably be said for the chick who plays Cat on that.
Yes, I agree. Who plays Catwoman, who goes by Cat for some reason. But yeah, she's good too. And I, you know, they do what they can. I don't know that Robert De Niro could do anything with that material.
No, he could.
But in any event. So yeah, we diverged there because I liked the kid. I thought his role was clever. I enjoy the seeing Tony being an ass to him, basically. Particularly one of my favorite scenes, and I'm shocked that you don't like this scene, Nick. When Tony's getting in the car here in a few minutes, and the kid comes up to him and he's trying to guilt trip him, and he says, "You're gonna leave me just like my dad," and Tony goes, "Yep."
Hey, I actually do like that scene because it's that stupid kid getting what he deserves.
And then the kid – and he goes, "Oh, you're trying to guilt trip me." And I can't remember what the last part of that line is, but he has another great line after that to the kid.
The kid says, "You can't leave me because you and I, we're connected." And then the kid's trying to keep him from leaving, and he says, "But I'm cold." And he says, "You're cold? I know you're cold. You know how I know? Because we're connected."
And then he drives off and leaves him in the cold.
Which is good. That aspect of it I like because again, fuck that
very
kid.
Funny. Very, very funny, very well written. So we move on from.
But the laugh, I think what I would say then, Greg, is the laughs that involve that kid all come from Tony, and none of them come from the kid.
Yeah, no, yes, certainly, yes, yes.
And I think there are times where we are intended to laugh because of the kid. Like, he is being given dialogue that is supposed to make us laugh, and it doesn't. For me, anyway.
Right, there's like a line or two of his that made me laugh, like when they meet up in the shack for the first time.
I maintain that him peppering Tony with questions during his PTSD attack is supposed to be funny, and it isn't.
Hmm. I think it's supposed to be mildly funny, but I think the main purpose of that scene was to set up the attack, which is not supposed to be funny in my opinion, in my viewing of the film. And as we know, Nick, everyone views the world through different eyes.
That's true.
The
world don't move to the beat of just one drum, Greg.
That's right. And sometimes, Nick, the world is not enough. Which, if we ever do a Bond podcast, would be another good one for us to debate. Because I know that we're on opposite sides on the world is not enough.
I think the world is not enough would be much like what our Ant-Man and Doctor Strange episodes are going to be. We disagree, but I don't think we'll disagree nearly as passionately as we do
probably.
About this. I like the world is not enough. You just seem to despise it for some reason.
Well, and it's doubtful we'll ever do a Bond podcast because I don't think we got time to watch 33 consecutive movies or whatever the hell it is, 25, whatever it is. So, nevertheless, world is not enough. Not very good in my opinion. But Back to the point at hand. So we diverge there, and do we want to talk? What do we want to keep going? We want to get into the Mandarin thing now, or do we want to go to the action scenes?
Oh,
what would you like? We got a few more topics to.
You're steering the ship, sir. I mean, if you want to jump right into the, you know, if you want to jump right into the shitstorm, I suppose we can.
Well, I guess before we get to the shitstorm, but so that we don't forget to talk about it, let's talk about the action
The
film, because that's something that I also had forgotten about, I think. Because when I think of this movie, I think of the jokes. I think of the banter back and forth. In particular, I think of the thrilling sequences where he infiltrates the Miami mansion. And, of course, when he and Rhodey are doing the assault on the AIM base at the very end, which is a great, you know, lethal weapon. It's basically a lethal weapon scene. I mean, let's be honest. It's Riggs and Murtaugh doing their thing, and it's awesome, which actually has my favorite moment in the entire movie that maybe we'll talk about later if I don't forget it. But the action in this movie is really good. I thought the sequence at the beginning, we didn't talk about it, when they attacked Tony's house was excellent. I thought it was really well put together. The CGI, I don't know if any of it was practical, but it didn't look as phony and as fake as a lot of these CGI-heavy action sequences do in superhero movies. I thought it was really well put together. It was clever. And that's probably the biggest compliment I could pay Shane Black for his direction in this one and his cinematographers, whoever they may be. They really came up with some clever ways to use Iron Man's particular skill set to create these action set pieces. In particular, that scene where they're attacking the mansion is a standout, and probably one of the best examples I can think of in recent memory of a true superheroic rescue moment, where they're all thrown out of the plane. All of these diplomats or bureaucrats or whatever are thrown out of the plane at a high altitude, and Tony has to devise a way to save them before they splat into the earth below. I thought that was a really cool sequence, right out of a comic. Completely unrealistic, no doubt, but it seemed like one of the most comic book-like sequences maybe of all the Marvel movies to this point, at least of all the solo Marvel movies. It was really fantastic and well put together. The CGI was great. So I was really impressed with the action in this movie, even if the extremist effects were not the best. I will admit that. But what were your thoughts on the action set pieces in Iron Man 3?
Yeah, for the most part, the ones that involve Tony, you know, actually in the suit, I enjoyed. I liked the little assault on the compound as well, although I find it it's a little weird, because that sequence, he's taking down people left and right like he's a trained, like, hand-to-hand fighter, and then like two scenes later they show him not knowing how to, like, hold a gun or cover Rhodey's back, and so he goes from super capable to basically feckless in the course of like three scenes. So that's kind of interesting, the internal inconsistency on what exactly Tony is capable of without his suit. But I know that Shane Black set out to make a movie where they didn't want him in the suit as much, but I found myself kind of missing the extended suit sequences. I think the suit sequences are one of the coolest aspects of Iron Man films, and I kind of missed them a little bit here. I didn't think they were enough for my taste.
Interesting. Yeah, I really enjoyed that sequence just because.
No, I enjoyed the sequence as well. Yeah, it's just I found it a couple scenes later when he and Rhodey are doing, you know, going to track down the Mandarin or whatever. I thought it was just a little bit of minor quibble, you know.
Oh, sure.
Just a little internal inconsistency, you know.
And while I'll go ahead and mention, while I'm thinking about it, my favorite scene in the entire movie, and it's weird, this would be my favorite scene in the whole movie because it's such a small bit. But my favorite bit in the entire movie is in the last act, when they're infiltrating the big AIM base at the end. You know, he and Rhodey, they're making their way through the girders. It's almost like this Lethal Weapon 3 like structure, if you've ever seen that movie. And they're making their way through these weird girders and whatnot, and and Rhodey wants Tony to check out what's going on. And so Tony, like, pops his head out of the box to scope things out and drops back down. Like you see in every action movie, literally every buddy cop action movie has done the scene where they peek over to see what's going on. They get shot out, and they go back down, and they kind of scope it out and say, yeah, we got three on the roof or whatever. Well, Tony does this, and he goes back down, and Rhodey says, what did you see? And Tony goes, too fast, nothing. I love that. That is just such – I love – as you know from I Love the Expendables, I love any scene that will kind of take the cliches of the genre that I love so much, which is action films, and kind of turn them on their head a little bit. That was just a very nice wink and a nod to some movies that Shane Black himself has written. So I love that bit with those two. But yeah, so – and that's part of that kind of – dynamic between Tony and Rhodey that makes the movie work in many ways. So now let us talk about a character that is probably the biggest bone of contention amongst many and the biggest point of praise for many. And that would be the character of the Mandarin. Now, who exactly, some might be asking, is the Mandarin? Well, I'm glad you asked in some ways. Now, before we get too deep into this, Nick, I think we should probably let people know neither of us is exactly an authority on Iron Man lore. Is that fair to say?
No, that would be fair to say. I've read some, read pretty much all
as
of the Ultimate Universe stuff and kind of picked and chose my bits out of the mainstream Marvel continuity, but not an expert, to say the least. But it's one of those things that you always kind of hear when you read about characters you don't know a lot about. It's always that Cliff Notes version of, like, this is character X and his main villain is character Y, and so the way it's always been passed down through comics lore is that the Mandarin is kind of the premier Iron Man villain. To use a very bad analogy in terms of personality of the two characters, I've heard him compared at times almost like being the Joker to Iron Man's Batman, even though not a good comparison, in my opinion, based on my understanding.
No. And if anybody from we're both in the same generation, but from my age bracket, I'm a couple years older than Nick. And if anybody, because I don't think Nick, you didn't watch the Iron Man cartoon when you were a kid, did you?
I watched some of it. It was really bad, so I didn't watch a lot of it.
Anybody that remembers that cartoon, Mandarin was the green guy in that show. That was the bad guy.
Oh, yeah, they turned him green, didn't they?
Yeah, he was green, and he had the 10 rings on that were basically just – they essentially just shoot energy blasts, as I remember it. But this is not a character that is without controversy. So, Mandarin was created, as we mentioned, in the mid-60s. I'm going to look it up right now. I think the character was created in 1964 in Tales of Suspense number 50. Now, this character came during sort of a movement known as the Yellow Peril. Which is
and even beyond the Yellow Peril, Greg, let's make it clear that the 50s and 60s were not exactly a time for subtlety in comic book storytelling either. So you kind of combine the cultural forces of the time with the way comics were written back then, and you kind of have the Mandarin as one of the results of that.
Yes. The character that the Mandarin appears to have been based on was Fu Manchu, which was the considered the mascot of sorts of the Yellow Peril, which was designed as a fear-based look at Asian culture, especially East Asian culture. And essentially it was to present the concept that people from East Asia are a danger to the Western world. And this is a problem that had happened in, if you're familiar with the movies, the Charlie Chan movies, things like that. These were caricatures of Asian culture, and various Asian cultures, I should say, Chinese culture in particular, being
some have also have also lobbed these sorts of negative comments about these types of characters at the Ancient One as well. Over in
yes,
the Doctor Strange, albeit you know he's meant to portray the more stereotypical positive aspects of Asian culture.
And to not make this a Marvel specific thing, because these are characters that have stuck around,
right?
That have gotten this. But if you go back and look at the Golden Age of comics, I mean, Superman was fighting, you know, not very respectably drawn Asian caricatures at the height of World War II and stuff like that.
Yes.
So
I mean, that's the way
it's something that goes. It's something that goes back and permeates culture. I think the difference in this case is that these are characters that have stuck around,
right,
the Mandarin and the Ancient One, but in particular the Mandarin, who we're focusing on here. Now, that is not to say that the Mandarin is not without his defenders either, because the Mandarin, while he is a character steeped in this lore, has been one that has popped up from time to time. The issue that writers have had with the Mandarin is the need to change him and update him in a way. I remember when I was a kid, and maybe people don't remember this, one of the big storylines in X-Men comics was Psylocke and her body transfer. When she I'm really going to need Todd or Tim to explain this in greater detail.
Or Jeremy Reynolds.
But essentially, Psylocke was a British woman whose consciousness was transferred into the body of an Asian ninja woman, which may not exactly be the least stereotypical thing you can imagine. But that happened in the X-Men, and the Mandarin was kind of at the center of that. Claremont was using him, I think, at that time for some reason. So
he used his rings to facilitate the consciousness swap or something like that.
Something along those lines. So it's a he's a character that's been used a lot, and I believe that Matt Fraction is considered to be the best, most successful of reimagining Mandarin and kind of giving a serious take on him that worked for a lot of people. Haven't read it. Can't really speak to it, but nevertheless,
read a very small amount of it. But what I have read, it worked. I want to go back and read that at some point. But yeah, he did. He actually did an updated take on the origin, apparently, in Invincible Iron Man Annual Number 1, and also used him as a key figure in his Iron Man run. That is one of, if I you know, we have to say, the Matt Fraction run is generally regarded as one of the best creative runs in Iron Man's publication history.
Absolutely, yes. That's considered to be that. I have actually, Nick, the first volume of that. I've just never read it.
We should look into that.
We should, indeed. But nevertheless, we say, why are we talking about all this stuff, you might be asking yourself? Well, the answer is that it does tie into our discussion of this film, because Shane Black goes a different route with the Mandarin, because his view of the Mandarin is not very flattering. So what he decided to do with the character is, in my opinion, and this is where Nick and one of the ways where Nick and I diverge, and where a lot of people diverge, because there are strong opinions on both sides. I am firmly in the pro camp for this, but he basically committed or performed a Vince Russo swerve of sorts.
Swerve!
And as it turns out, the Mandarin who we see at the beginning of the movie and throughout the movie as being this evil terrorist character, even with references going back a couple of movies, is actually just a puppet. He's an actor who named Trevor, who AIM has recruited to play this terrorist character. And the reason is pretty brilliant, actually, in that AIM's goal is to have a public face of terrorism while also controlling the fight for terrorism. Against terrorism, rather. So they basically are playing both sides against each other, and they run it all from behind the scenes.
Yeah, they profit from both sides. They are the they have privatized the business of the war on terror, essentially.
Exactly. It's a brilliant plot, and what he does here is they have this really funny sequence. Actually, another one of my favorite bits in the movie, when they infiltrate this mansion in Miami to finally find the Mandarin, Tony is stunned that not only is the Mandarin a British actor, but he's a complete bumbling buffoon, and it's hilarious. Ben Kingsley does what I can only describe as an Austin Powers-like accent as he is playing this character of Trevor.
It's almost like a weird combination of Michael Caine's Nigel Powers and Ozzy Osbourne because there are moments where you don't really understand what he's saying, and he's just kind of stumbling around muttering to himself.
Yeah. So he sat on a turtle.
Sharon!
And when he at one point he even as he's bartering with for his life he even asks Tony if he'd like a go with one of the birds, referring to the two girls on his bed. Really funny stuff here. I don't know if he was supposed to be stoned or what the deal was, but he was really good banter here. Really good performance by Ben Kingsley. Laugh out loud moment. I remember in our theater watching it. It was probably the biggest laugh out loud scene. For most people in the movie. And so basically it's – the Mandarin is not the villain at all. The Mandarin is actually just a made-up creation of Aldrich Killian and AIM. And for me, the swerve got me because I didn't see it coming. And that's one thing – I don't believe anybody if they say that they saw this coming, because this was – this really caught me off guard.
Not to throw you off topic, but what terrible, ineffective security at this mansion, by the way, where Tony just climbs a tree and then jumps over the wall and nobody sees him. These guys are about as effective as Dr. Evil's henchmen in Goldmember. You've got no chance.
Just
throw your weapon down and lie down there.
Lie down there. You
know. You shoot him with a nail gun?
Good Lord. It sure looked like it, didn't it?
Would that really incapacitate someone, though, just getting being shot with a nail gun? I mean, it would hurt for sure, but, like, that guy keeled over into the fountain like he was dead.
A lot of drugs going on in this mansion,
that's
it
a
seems.
Good point. Then maybe these guys are all on drugs.
And this guy's rolling a booger in his finger for some reason.
I don't think it's a booger.
Come on,
that would
look
be
at
a
it.
Giant booger. That would be a 1980s WWF nostril booger. If it were.
You are obsessed with 80s nostrils all of a sudden. Every time I talk to you, 80s WWF nostrils.
When there are big nostrils, I assume they're used for cocaine snorting.
Oh, what about Diana Hart Smith's nostrils?
For fear of angering someone we may be starring in a future upcoming effort with, I'm not going to say anything about the fine Diana Hart Smith.
Yep. Just so long as it isn't some sort of a portrayal of Watchmen, you'd have to be
fucking
asshole
ridiculous.
Bastard to do that.
That would be you know, altering Watchmen to such a degree that it would be unrecognizable, almost like they did with the Mandarin here.
With the Mandarin here, yes. So that brings us to the crux of the point here, which is I'm for it, Nick's again it, and I'll get into more of my reasons why I'm for it in a moment, but I've talked for a while now, and I want to give Nick a chance to lay out why this is a bad move and why he doesn't like this reveal.
I'll be honest. The first time I saw it, it didn't really bug me. An interesting counterpoint to make between Iron Man 3 and another film that came out later that year, because that was the same year as Man of Steel, correct, Greg? I believe that's the case, 2013.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
I described it to both to everyone that I walked that I saw both with as this. Very similar reactions to both films for me sitting in the theater. But when I walked out of in the months that followed Iron Man 3, the things that kept sticking in my head about it were the things I didn't like. Whereas with Man of Steel, the things that kept sticking in my head were the things I did like. And so this thing has kind of been something that has slowly just kind of bugged me more and more over time, because while I think Ben Kingsley gives a good performance, and while I think the scenes are legitimately funny, I'm not going to sit here and deny that they're not funny. I mean, I don't know how you could watch this and say they're not funny. I think that choosing to portray the Mandarin as nothing more than a joke and nothing more than for comedic relief is a little bit lazy, in my opinion. And I think it speaks to one of the flaws I feel this film has, is that when in doubt, throw in a joke, even if it doesn't necessarily fit the scene. I am all for humor in my Iron Man movies. We've talked before about how, to me, the perfect Iron Man movie has an equal balance of humor, drama, and action. And that's why I still think the first one is the best one, because it struck that balance so well. I think that the subsequent sequels, as we discussed with Iron Man 2, swung it too far into the dramatic territory, and I think this one swung it too far into trying to play it as a straight-out comedy. And this is one of the things about it that bugged me. And when I say lazy, I don't disagree with the idea that there was a need to provide an alternate take on the Mandarin, an updating of the character to get away from the unfortunate overtones of the character. I absolutely agree with that. However, I think there is a way to do that, to reinvent the character while staying true to some of the things that made people, that kept him coming around in the comics for years, you know, his ingenuity, the level of genuine threat he brought into Tony's life. And I think there's a way to do that without making him a joke and making him the Mandarin in name only.
Let me ask you this, Nick. What about if they'd done that, if they'd made him just a character that adds a threat to Tony's life and is ingenious, how does that make him different than any of the other villains we've seen in the Iron Man movies?
Well, they easily could have done something with the Ten Rings, as they've been teasing throughout the first two films, and perhaps realized that he had been more – revealed that he had been more involved with the machinations and ongoing events of the first two films than Tony had believed in the past. Because originally – and I think it's still in a deleted scene. But don't quote me on this. In Iron Man 2, near the beginning when Vanko gets the file of information on Tony Stark, if you remember that, originally that was supposed to be a Ten Rings operative who was giving him that – the passport, that's what he was getting. He was getting the passport and the falsified identity so he could travel to Monaco to confront Tony at the race. That's what it was. Sorry, not a file of information. But in any event, that was actually supposed to be a Ten Rings operative. And the folder he handed him actually had a Ten Rings logo on it. And I always liked that idea of having the Ten Rings reimagined as a terrorist organization and playing a role in the Iron Man franchise, but you slow build it to actually having the confrontation between them. And it makes me wonder if perhaps that wasn't actually the idea because, I don't know if we want to get into this or not, because of the existence of the subsequent Marvel one-shot where Ben Kingsley made his return.
We'll get to that in a minute, but I want to address a couple of things. But first of all, about the Ten Rings, thing still works though, Nick, because the Ten Rings organization still exists, as I understand it, in this film. It's just a puppet organization. It's not real. There are actual operatives out there.
And see, that's difficult. It's difficult because it's almost difficult to have that conversation without talking about the one shot. Because are we?
Right.
That's canon, right? I mean, we have
No. It is. But we're going off of what we know up to this point.
Exactly. Difficult. And that's one thing. You know, it's difficult to have this conversation and take away the knowledge that we have now. You know, you can't.
See, I can because I haven't seen it. And I don't want to see it because I don't like the idea of it, which we'll get to in a minute.
Yeah. But
you want to talk about lazy? That was lazy. We'll get to that though, because I cannot disagree with you more about a topic. I don't know that we've discussed a topic. In fact, we have it that we disagree more on than this because I think that it's far from lazy. I think it's the farthest from lazy that you could get because it takes balls to do something like this. It takes balls to do a non-generic take on a crappy character that has
Wait a minute. How many times have we said on this show and in public and in private conversations?
Sure. There's no. I know such you're going to go. There's no such thing as a bad character. Yeah. Absolutely, Nick. And how many times have we seen parody takes on old characters in comics we love and have loved them and had no issues with them, whether it be Captain Boomerang portrayed as a fat, bumbling idiot, whether it be the Riddler portrayed as a joke character who gets the crap beaten out of him by Bane, whether it be any number of characters we've seen crop up over the years, and we've been fine with it because not every character needs to be this big, bad, menacing threat, especially if it's a character rooted in racism, a character rooted in cheese, a character
Okay. To be fair, every character is rooted in cheese. Pretty much any character who was created in the 1950s or 60s is rooted in cheese. So you can't really take that as an indictment against the Mandarin in particular. I'm not gonna fight you on the racist, connotations of the character's origins. But I would also argue to your other point about parody versions of characters. That's in the comics, Greg, where we have decades of stories to tell with these characters, and there's room for all these different interpretations.
Why is there not room in the movies?
I'm not saying there isn't, but I am saying that you use the Riddler as an example. In the comics, if you don't like that version of the Riddler, guess what? 5 to 10 years from now, another version of the Riddler is going to come along.
What if you don't like this version of the Mandarin that's serious?
You know, that,
why are you presuming that everyone wants a serious version of the Mandarin?
I am not presuming that everyone wants a serious version of the Mandarin, Greg. I am presuming that I would have preferred a more serious take on the Mandarin.
And here's my – and here, but again, you're laying it out under the presumption that if you only have one version of a character, it needs to be a serious version of that character. And that's just not true.
No, I am not saying that, you know, you can only do serious takes on characters. I am saying for a character that has the profile of the Mandarin and has had the involvement with the history of Tony Stark in the comics, you know, like the Mandarin has had, I think there was an opportunity to do something a little bit more memorable with the Mandarin and a little bit less divisive.
I would argue this is more memorable than anything they could have done otherwise.
It is very memorable. I'll give you that. But you said earlier that it really takes balls to do something like that, and I don't agree, because as I said before, this movie's default position seems to be when in doubt, go for laughs. And so I don't think it takes balls to fall back on your default position.
I think that the Iron Man franchise's gimmick is that every one of the movies,
and I disagree with that. As I have said before, would you not agree that this one goes for laughs more often than the other two films?
Yes, I would agree with that.
That's all I'm saying. I mean, that's really,
and I think it succeeds. By the way, and I think that's fine. I think that
it succeeds for the most part.
I don't want Iron Man movies that look like Captain America movies that look like Thor movies or that look like anything else.
I agree with that, and that's something, you know, that we'll discuss, I'm sure, more in the months leading up to Thor Ragnarok. But that's my biggest concern about Thor Ragnarok, is that it seems like they have my hesitation on the trailers for that is it seems like they have taken the Thor formula and tried to do Guardians of the Galaxy with it. But that's another topic.
Well, yeah, but that's off topic for Slayton.
Yes.
But yes, so more to the point, I think we've both made our points and made good points at that, but I think that you can take a character and you can do something different with them. And to me it's ballsy because nobody saw this coming. To me, anytime you do something in a movie that nobody saw coming, at the very least, it's ballsy. It's not safe. It's not safe. It's not lazy. It's something. And sometimes it's not going to work. Sometimes you see swerves that are stupid and shouldn't be thrown in. In my opinion, this is a swerve that works, at least for me. And yes, it's going to divide the audience. But I don't think that the Mandarin thing divided moviegoers as much as it has divided comic book people.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That I can certainly agree with. But that's the nature of our community. You know, we're going to look at these things a little bit differently.
But I look at it as, like, you know, something like Batman Forever. They have a comedic take my problem is not that you do a comedic take on the Riddler, or even that you do a comedic take on Two-Face. The problem is that every character in that franchise at that point, or not at that point, but going forward, had two comedic takes on villains.
Okay.
And then the next movie had, three comedic takes on villains. So I'm not arguing that – by no means am I saying that Whiplash and Justin Hammer and Stain and all these – whatever other Iron Man characters there are, Killian, for instance. I'm not saying any of these characters should have been comedy characters, or all of them should have been. But I'm saying – I've got no problem if after two movies of getting serious threats to Tony Stark in the form of a wealthy, angry businessman who wants his company – wants to steal Tony's company from him, then in the form of an angry Russian out for revenge Justin Hammer is.
Now, to be fair, I was about to say that we already had a villain that was played for comedy in Iron Man 2.
For comedy, yes, Justin Hammer. Although I would argue it's significantly different in terms of it's not the real villain.
Yeah,
Mandarin is not the real villain here. He is a pawn, and there's the actual villain, Killian, is not played for laughs. He's played for, you know, almost to a fault, played seriously. To the point where I was waiting for some more bombast, I think, from the character towards the end. But
you know who this henchman – sorry, not to interrupt you, but you know who this henchman guy here looks like?
Van Hammer?
Well, I was going to say he looks kind of like the evil dad from Kindergarten Cop.
Oh my God, Richard Tyson. Yes.
I mean, that's not him, clearly, but it looks kind of like him in my
opinion. Funny story about Richard Tyson. Not funny at all, actually. Just information.
He's from Mobile, Alabama.
Mobile, Alabama. You know who else is from Mobile, Alabama, Nick?
AJ McCarron.
That's absolutely right. You know who else is from Mobile, Alabama, though?
God. Do we have to keep going?
Bob Sparkplug Holly.
Bob Sparkplug Holly.
Yes, sir.
Oh, yay. He said Mobile. That's where I'm from.
You're damn right. That's where I'm from. Now, in addition to that, Richard Tyson's brother, John Tyson, was the district attorney of Mobile County. So,
can we move on? Past
I want to talk about Kindergarten Cop.
Of the Tyson family and their fine reputation in Mobile County.
Now, Kith. basically, what we're getting at is I like the Mandarin being treated as a joke. Nick doesn't. So,
yeah,
anything else we can add to that discussion?
I don't think so. I mean, I guess it's not technically part of the canon at this point, but I kind of feel like that discussion is incomplete without discussing the one shot.
Yes. So, after the making of Iron Man 3, unless you understand this to be different, tell me if I'm telling this story wrong.
Okay. So basically.
Yeah, go ahead.
Starting with Iron Man 2, for DVD releases, Marvel would do these little short films that they called Marvel One-Shots. And they were little 3 to 5, 7-minute films set in the MCU that were attached just as bonus features. But they were very much set as canon. I'm sorry, I was blanking on the term there. And so I'm trying to remember the film that it was attached to. Yes, so when Thor the Dark World, which will be our next Hard Travelers for Hire, you know, episode that we'll do in August, when Thor the Dark World was released on video, it contained with it the latest Marvel one-shot, a short film entitled All Hail the King. And so what happened here, I'll let Greg give his memories of it, because I'm interested to hear how much he actually knows about it, seeing as how he hasn't seen it.
Yeah, so basically my understanding is that, and again, I could be very wrong, basically Marvel wanted to kind of walk back the Mandarin thing in Iron Man 3. And so as a result, they did this one shot where in some form or fashion, I don't know the details of it, but it's revealed that the Mandarin is real. And they send 10 rings operatives, I guess, to confront and or kill Trevor, the character that Ben Kingsley plays in prison. Is that correct, Nick? I don't know.
Yeah, so basically the premise of it is that a documentary filmmaker has come to doing a documentary about the events of Iron Man 3 and is seeking to gain the first exclusive interview with Trevor. And so he kind of talks to him and asks him basic questions. And throughout the short film, the nature of the questions becomes increasingly more aggressive. And eventually the guy asks him, are you aware of the actual organization, the Ten Rings, and the rumor that they are led by an individual who calls himself the Mandarin? And Trevor, being Trevor, is oblivious to this fact and has no idea. And eventually, the documentary filmmaker reveals himself to actually be a member of the Ten Rings and then kidnaps Trevor and breaks him out of the prison and takes him seemingly to meet the real Mandarin. Interestingly enough, something that might make you actually want to watch the film, you know who also cameos in that short film?
Who's that?
Sam Rockwell as Justin Hammer.
Oh my God.
Now what do you do? The tables have turned, Darkness.
Tables have turned. I might have to find a way to watch this somehow. Yes, that's interesting. See, that's interesting. But I do not like that, because to me it seems like I'm in 100% support of the swerve. But if you don't have faith in the swerve, then don't do the swerve. If you're going to walk, I would agree with that.
I mean, once you're pot committed, you should go either way. You know, based on, you know, the various things from the special features of the first two films and kind of the things they were laid out, I'm of the belief that the decision to do the Mandarin swerve was a Shane Black thing. That is my take on it.
And
it
was kind
of one of the rare instances of Kevin Feige being willing to alter the long-term plan for it to allow for a directorial vision. And perhaps he kind of regretted it, and this was responsible for it. And perhaps that's kind of, you know, this is one of the nails in the coffin, so to speak, for Feige kind of locking down, you know, what we've reportedly heard as the strict directorial vision that Marvel now has for its films, where they don't really encourage as much freelancing and improvisation for any director not named James Gunn.
Right. Yeah. So, I agree. I agree with that. If you're Feige and you have a problem with it, then you take it out before the movie's made. But I hate it any time in storytelling when you commit to something and then you try to walk it back later. And we see it in comics all the time.
Is this the first MCU retcon, by the way?
Yes, I believe so. Unless there's one that we're forgetting about or I'm forgetting about.
Yeah, I think it might be. And what's exceptionally weird about it is I think we all pretty much assumed that this was the final Iron Man solo film we were going to get. And so I don't even know that there's any plans to follow up on this, which makes it even weirder in hindsight.
Right, absolutely. It's certainly unusual. I suppose that if they do more Iron Man movies, even if it's James Rhodes in the suit instead of Tony Stark, that you could follow up on it, but it's, you know, I don't know that that's ever going to happen because I don't know if they'll ever have faith to do an Iron Man movie without Tony Stark in the role. But you know, we'll see whatever becomes of that. But that is certainly a somewhat of a unique situation. I think it's fair to, you know, it's fair to say that.
Has Shane Black ever commented on what he thought about the short, or if he's seen it?
Oh, that is a great question. I believe he may have, actually. I'm not 1,000% sure of that. I actually found an interview with him talking about the Mandarin, and this is from last year when he was promoting The Nice Guys. Here's what he says about his take on the character. He says, "We may have done our job a bit too well in a way because we succeeded in actually having a surprise in the middle of a big summer movie where you normally know virtually everything about it before you go in. And when I say we did our job too well, it means that some of the fans felt fooled. They felt, I think, that they'd been led down one path and then sold a bill of goods. It's hard because I want to please the fans. But in this case, I thought, and we all thought at the time, that it was just a very interesting and very layered decision to take the Mandarin in. We had this think tank, AIM, from the comics, and all of a sudden, okay, what if this was cobbled together as a sort of boogeyman that they'd researched? They actually had data spit out about the various things that people would find frightening and they would concoct from this. This sort of straw man terrorist, this paper tiger, and then push him on the internet. I thought that felt modern, it felt interesting, it felt textured. I thought to myself, hey, Whiplash is in Iron Man 2. He doesn't look like Whiplash in the comics. People like it when you trade up and kind of shake it up a little. And the truth is, people did. I mean, we made a lot of money with the movie, and there is a hardcore niche of fandom that was genuinely disappointed. They wanted to see their version, and for that I feel bad. However, I still like the choice that we made. When asked whether he would have adapted the character more faithfully, he says, quote, "Of course not. The minute you start to govern your creative impulses based on anticipation of someone else's response or their expectations, then you're going to fail. And you're going to fail them too, because you're not going to surprise anybody. You're going to be busy second-guessing what other people want and indulging that people-pleasing side of yourself." So he doesn't directly address the short, but I can assume based on the way he describes it, I can assume that he wouldn't have probably been a fan of it.
I found another interview that was released in May of 2016, and he says in an interview with UpRocks, he said, "Marvel saw so many negative things, they made a whole other movie just to apologize called Hail to the King, in which they said, no, no, the Mandarin is still alive. That wasn't him. There's a real Mandarin. The only reason they made that was as an apology to the fans who were so angry." And he later went on to say, when asked if they had any expectation that they would receive blowback, he said, "No, we didn't. We didn't know. We all thought they'd eat it up because it never occurred to us that the Mandarin might be as iconic to people as, say, the Joker and Batman. We thought they just wanted to see the magic ring shoot lasers. And he later went on to say that part of the reason for the change was the magic element of the character, not the – or part of the reason for the change. I'm assuming the racial overtones also played a factor. He said, you need to take the piss out of it and explain how this can happen. In the comic books, it's literally magic. It's magic from outer space. He went on to add, I'm a people pleaser. I love the fans. I really wanted to please them.
Gotcha. So he did not like the short.
No, you can't expect him to. I mean,
no. I mean, and I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong to do that because if you commit to a decision, it needs to be a decision that sticks. It would be, you know, there were people that were upset, and we've had this discussion many times, Nick. To go back to The Dark Knight, people were upset at the fate of Harvey Dent. To us, to both of us, our viewing of that movie, there was no doubt that he was dead at the end of that movie, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was both upset and pleased because I was upset because I, as the massive Two-Face mark that I am, I wanted more Two-Face. But as a fan of logical storytelling, that movie is about the rise and fall of Harvey Dent. You can't tell a complete story with his story being left open-ended.
And this would be like if Nolan had seen reaction to that and said, you know what, even though my plan wasn't to have him in the movie, let's change it and have Harvey included because people are going to be upset if we don't.
Right.
So, you know, it's one of those deals where I know that we diverge on whether they should have done it or not. I'm glad they did it. You wish they didn't do it. But both of us agree they should have stuck to the decision, right?
Yeah, either way. Either stick to the directorial vision that Shane Black laid out or – if you're Kevin Feige and you're having to be talked into doing it anyway, just stick to the long-term vision you have. Like, you know, one way or the other, decide your vision and go with it. And that's not what they did here.
Right. And from the way Black describes it, it almost sounds like Feige was 100% on board until they started seeing the reactions come in.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's
– Feige has always been very, very aggressive in courting positive fan reaction. You get the impression that it means a lot to him to have him – to have the Marvel films be – not just well-received, but beloved by the fan community.
So, because I forgot that we mentioned we'd talk about it later, we're running a little long here as we figured we would. But towards the end of the movie, we get the big climactic action sequence. And this is the one where Pepper Potts is injected with Extremis and seemingly plummets to her doom, only to come back at the end of the movie and save the day for Tony Stark. And so that's what we were referring to earlier when she's not necessarily a normal person at that point. She doesn't become a superhero per se, but she fulfills the role of a superhero by saving Tony's ass, essentially, for the second time in the movie. So pretty interesting flipping of the traditional roles, particularly as it comes to MCU movies. So that pretty much brings us to the end of the motion picture as we get to the Lethal Weapon sequence here. I feel like we've been talking about this movie for 30 years, but it's actually been a fun conversation, Nick. Folks, you can actually enjoy talking with someone with whom you disagree about a subject.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's part of the entire basis of our friendship is finding things to bitch at one another about. So
absolutely. Jeff Jarrett, the Intercontinental title and child actors.
Bobby Lashley. Although you've come around.
Bobby's been bringing it.
I picked my hill 10 years ago, Greg, to die on, and I sat there and I waited. And I waited for you to come back.
But let me ask you this, Nick. If a Bobby Lashley improves and nobody sees him, did he ever really improve in the first place?
I saw it, damn it. I saw it. That's all that matters.
With that being said, Iron Man 3, as we mentioned at the beginning of the telecast, not really telecast, podcast even, it's a good movie.
Yes.
So I love this movie. I really, really love it. And actually I have this issue with the Iron Man movies where separating them is very difficult for me because I love them all for different reasons. Nick, your appraisal of Iron Man 3.
Oh, what are we looking for? Like a letter grade, a number grade? What
Your general impression of it.
I like the film. I think it is mostly effective at what it tries to do. However, as I said earlier, I think it is a film that doesn't have the balance that I look for out of an Iron Man film, that that tripod, if you will, Greg. There we go. There's a good reference. The tripod that I like an Iron Man film to stand upon, and I think that the humor leg of it is leaned upon far too much for my taste. And that's not to say I don't enjoy the humorous elements of the film. I do. It's just it feels like that is the entire point of the film here, whereas the other Iron Man films I think are a bit more in balance.
There's so many directions I can go with what you just set me up with there, Nick. Now, how would this tripod compare to the tripod of, say, one Nature Boy Ric Flair?
Or Too Cold Scorpio, for that matter.
Or Colonel Robert Parker and the Parker Jump Rope Academy.
Or Red Bastien.
The Colonel, if you will. Also, does the tripod of Iron Man have the same flexibility, in your opinion, in the elements that a certain Polish kielbasa might have if you wet it for a while?
Under warm water. Okay. Greg, your thoughts on Iron Man 3?
It's like a baby's arm holding an apple. I'm a big fan of Iron Man 3. I love this film. I think it's the funniest of the Iron Man movies. I think it's it's not without its flaws, certainly. I mean, I think that there are aspects that probably could have been done better. Maybe if Shane Black had been able to make exactly the movie he wanted to make, I think it would be better remembered by many. But that being said, I make no apologies for my love of this movie. I think it's great. I thought Iron Man 2 was great, for the record. I really, really enjoyed this movie. I think the Iron Man movies in many ways have improved with each entry. I think the action in this one is maybe even more clever than – we had a lot of praise for the action scenes in Iron Man 2, which I think surprised us because neither one of us
remembered them
being that good. Exactly.
In hindsight, now that we finished all three of them, I think that damn car chase scene in Iron Man 2, the race scene, might be the best action sequence in the entire trilogy. For my money,
I think
it's amazing.
I might agree. I might agree with that because that it really caught me off guard how good it was. So, but yeah, I think this is a great movie in its own right and one of my favorites in the MCU. So that brings us to that, and I know you've got a new element you'd like to introduce.
Yeah, let's do that last.
Old Faithful, and here's the problem that we have here, Nick. I can't remember what my rankings were because it's been so long since we've done the damn podcast.
Yeah.
So there's a chance I could be violating our own continuity here, Nick. What should I do?
I'm pretty sure I know what your rankings were, but let's hear them. And if I think you're misordering things, I'll let you know.
Okay. So off the top of my head.
7-1 or 1-7?
I'm going to go – we love to count things down, but it's going to be hard for me to do it that way without in the current situation of my mind.
Yeah,
so I'm going to go from the top down. Avengers.
Okay.
Rather comfortably.
Yeah.
Oh, God, this is tough. Iron Man – two.
Wow.
Iron Man 3.
You have changed your opinion in recent years.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough that I think Iron Man 2 is so much better than I remembered it being.
Yeah, I would agree. I think Iron Man 2 is one of those films that was helped by our rewatch. For me anyway.
Right. So it's very those are the two that are the closest for me
so
in terms
you're saying for the record, the Avengers, Iron Man 2, and then Iron Man 3.
Yes, and then Iron Man.
Okay.
And then it would have to be Captain America, the First Avenger, I think.
I think you had Thor ahead of Captain America.
Thor. Well, whichever one of those is ahead of the other one. Right now I would lean Captain America, the First Avenger, but let's say Thor if it is Thor. Okay. Captain America.
I mean, this is all, dependent on our mood right now. So, Greg, rank them however the hell you want. So you're saying Avengers 1. Iron Man 2 is 2. Iron Man 3 is 3. Iron Man is 4. Captain America is 5. Thor is 6. And that would leave the Incredible Hulk
at 7. Yeah, and the gap between Thor and the Incredible Hulk is pretty fair. And that's not to knock the Incredible Hulk. I like that one too. But there's a gap between Thor and the Incredible Hulk, I think.
All right. I'm going to give you mine. And here we go. and Greg's gonna get a little hot, I'm afraid. I'm going the Avengers at 1.
Yep.
I'm going Iron Man at 2.
Okay.
I am going Thor at 3. I am going
All right.
Captain America at 4.
Oh, wow.
I'm going Iron Man 2 at 5. I'm going The Incredible Hulk at 6. And I'm going Iron Man 3 at 7.
Oh, good. Good Lord. You kidding me?
I'm not kidding you. That's my appraisal of it.
Tommy Rich has no teeth. I'm almost speechless. I am almost speechless at this ranking. All I will say for anyone, for our listeners out there, hashtag Team Iron Man. And
wait a minute, are you suggesting that I'm anti-Iron Man? Like, what exactly are you implying here?
I'm saying that you appear to favor other members of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Really?
Over Iron Man.
So which film is my top ranked solo movie to this point again?
Iron Man.
There you are.
I'm just saying. There is a contingent out there that would say hashtag Team Cap, and I feel like you might find yourself on that.
If you're counting the movies that have Captain America in the title as actual Captain America movies and not as Avengers movies, I don't think there's any question, in my mind anyway, the Captain America trilogy far outpaces the Iron Man trilogy in terms of consistency.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. I would say that the consistency isn't there because Captain America 2 and 3 are so much better than Captain America 1.
And I would say that Iron Man 1 is so much better than Iron Man 2 or 3.
That's where we diverge. I feel – and I know I'm – by the way, I know I am in the vast minority. But there's no question about that. Critically, I am undoubtedly considered a fool for this opinion. But I feel like the Iron Man movies have steadily either gotten better or just stepped up a level from the first one. And I like the first one a lot, no doubt. I really like it. But I don't know. I just prefer the second two. And, you know, but then again, I also like Man of Steel. And so,
yeah, that's a good point. You know, we both like Man of Steel, though.
You know, what can you say? So, with that being said, folks, those are our rankings to this point. And this was one of our longest podcasts we've done in a long time. We got more to come on the other end.
Oh, Greg, you forgot the new element we wanted to introduce.
Oh, that's right. Yes, we do have a new element. Nick, you take over for this segment.
Yeah, so, you know, as you know, we close out these Hard Travelers for Hire with us unveiling our rankings of, you know, where each film kind of ranks in the MCU movies that have been released up to that point. And so we kind of came up with the idea of, well, and it was kind of spurred by an online comment that Greg made earlier this week where he talked about, you know, a generally overwhelmingly positive critical response to Iron Man 3. And I kind of was like, I don't remember that being the case. So I actually went back and looked at some of the critical responses to the MCU films. And so I thought kind of as a nice counterpoint, just to see where Greg and I each compare to the general response to each of these films, I am unveiling for the first time, we're going to start doing what I call a little composite ranking. What I have done is I have pulled the Rotten Tomatoes critic score, the Rotten Tomatoes fan score, and the Metacritic score for each of these films and combined them together to get a point total and have ranked the films based on a combination of critical and fan response. And so, with all that being said, Greg, let's unveil these for the first time. Am I going 1-7 or 7-1?
For consistency, let's go 1-7 since we both did with ours.
All right, fair enough. According to these composite rankings, critics and fans have Iron Man at number 1, The Avengers at number 2, Captain America at number 3, Iron Man 3 at number 4, Thor at number 5, Iron Man 2 at number 6, and The Incredible Hulk at number 7.
Interesting. So, little bit of bones thrown both our ways.
Yeah,
on that one.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for the record, as I think about it, oh God, it's hard for me. Thor and Captain America are also pretty tough to separate because they both had strengths and weaknesses, mm-hmm. Pretty severely. But I did like Thor, first Thor. So I don't know. We'll see.
Oh, are you teasing? Are you teasing another installment of our debate next week or next month?
I think that we are.
I have reached the point with the movie we're going to discuss next month where I have given up defending it because it's just like I can offer no rationale as to why I love this movie as much as I do.
Understandable. It's kind of like me with most Arnold movies.
Yeah.
Or even Stallone movies, probably a better instance, because we all know all Arnold movies are great.
Yes.
But Cobra, many don't appreciate the subtleties of Cobra. Nevertheless, that does bring us to the end of this. Please let us know what your thoughts are on Iron Man 3 in particular, and also on our MCU rankings to this point. You can contact us via Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. You can email us. I am gregp@placetobenation.com. He is nickd@placetobenation.com. Or, most preferably, you can join our Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page and just type in Place to Be Nation Comics on your search bar. Should come up. Join the group and let us know your thoughts on Iron Man 3, your MCU rankings up through Iron Man 3, and what you think about our rankings and what you think about the critics' rankings. Weigh in on the Mandarin controversy. Are you a big Mandarin fan? Do you hate the Mandarin? Do you like Mandarin oranges? Let us know. We're interested in all of this. So let us know is what we're getting at here. With all that being said, when we come back from the break, we're going to have the rundown. We're going to have read and watch, and we'll try to be as brief as possible with those, I promise.
Well, you know the problem with that, Greg, is because we had the halfies last week, it's actually going to cover 2 weeks of reading and 2 weeks of rundown. So we may be going Peter Jackson length on this one.
Oh, my. Nick, do you realize what this means? I think it's appropriate. I think this is a bit of divine intervention, because you might say that we're getting ready to have an Iron Man match.
Oh, and there we're going to wrestle for 60 minutes. Jim Ross would love this podcast. Quite frankly, there's never anything, nothing is ever hurt by a time limit draw.
Quite frankly, why are so many people afraid to do a time limit draw? We see these impotent finishes every week,
Greg,
where you stop at 2 hours.
I swear to you, I am not even joking about this. One of my most anticipated events in life is getting to listen to Jim Ross call Omega Okada 2, if only for the finish. Because I'm expecting just like jubilation. Jim Ross is going to go through the full positive spectrum of emotions in the course of about 20 seconds, and it's going to be amazing.
I have seen the face of the mountain, and it is good! With that being said,
we're getting way off topic.
We will be back in just a few moments. Please listen to a message from our lovely sponsors and some of the other podcasts here at Place to Be Nation Pop.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Coming soon from the creative minds of the Place to Be Nation Pop Network, the audio adaptation that no one was asking for, but everyone deserved. Place to Be Nation Pop Comic Book Theater presents Watchmen, an audio feast for your ears, thrilled to the exploits of the comedian.
These are demons! It's an intergalactic invasion into this space through people. They have sexual rituals, some of the most ancient Egyptian rituals, where they believe they are possessed by entities, space aliens.
Silk Spectre.
Good. Hey, licking your finger, it's like licking a battery. It's all sort of...
Night Owl.
Yeah, well, you know how it goes. Sometimes I come down here and sit around a little bit, think about the times when we were making the towns, doing the drugs, fucking the rats.
Dr. Manhattan.
Clearly, you don't really care about what stimulates me.
Ozymandias.
Put down the Soviets. Vietnam? Anyone? Anyone? Mila Jovovich?
And Rorschach.
But what it doesn't change is the fact, and this is something we can all agree on, that all of the whores and politicians will look up and they'll shout, "Save us, JR!" And I'll look down and I'll whisper, "Mom."
You won't believe your ears. You won't believe the dark places your imagination will take you. Featuring cameos from some of your PTBN favorites.
Baby, that's quite a drop, I said.
Oh, they're just paying me to handle monsters in outer space? No, no.
Maybe it was a couple of guys and they overpowered him.
He cometh up and swerve, cut down like a flower.
Fly me to the moon, let me fuck amongst my star. Oh, I guess Dr. Osterman finally arrived.
It's Watchmen, the greatest graphic novel of all time, as you've never heard it before. Transformed into the most self-referential collection of in-jokes on this or any other medium. Only from the hard-traveling fanboys and Place to Be Nation Pop.
Welcome back. Ladies and gentlemen, after that somewhat contentious discussion about Iron Man 3, that I think we came out on the other side good on, we respectfully disagreed on things. Isn't that nice, Nick? Isn't that a bit of a refreshing change of pace from the lay of the land?
From the lay of our own land, our mutual land between the two of us, or the lay of the general land? Because
the lay of the general land.
I can definitely agree with that. As we said in the first half, the internet is a place where things can only be the best thing ever or the worst thing ever, and it's odd to have any kind of discussion about any sort of nuance. So that was nice. And full disclosure, folks, I have actually lived a life, an entire lifetime, in between the first half of this show and the second half of this show.
This may have, to the listeners, this may only have felt like about a 90-second break. But believe you me, this has been a damn near a week-long break for us. I mean, just – it's felt like it anyway.
Yeah.
The longest 90 seconds of our lives, Nick.
Absolutely. In those 90 seconds, I learned so much, Greg. I learned about squirrels and trees of idiocy. I learned about Boom Boom and songs about words. And I learned about, well, cutting people's dicks off and throwing them in the trash. But quite frankly, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah. Now, does any of this have to do with Ray's Boom Boom Room? That's the question.
Unfortunately, no. Unfortunately, no, it does not. Ray's Boom Boom Room would have been a much better place to spend the last 90 seconds than the place I spent it. So,
yes. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what we've just done there is called an aside. And what that is when we reference things that literally five other human beings on the planet could possibly
get. Five? Let's see. Wait a minute. Let me think. Give me a minute. It's me and you. That's two.
Okay. I forgot about you. Yeah.
And then there's Russell and Jenny, Carrie, and Miranda, Carrie, and David, and Tim, and Todd. So there's six besides us.
Carry the two. And nevertheless, folks, we are here on the
seven.
Garner, yeah. We're now here on the backside of the show. We're here on the backside of the show, my boy, to talk about the usual segments that we get to every week. Now, because we went so long with our Iron Man 3 discussion, we've elected not to do the rundown this week.
Right, and also
next week.
Yeah, and also because you know this is our first regular episode after a giant size, so we have two weeks worth of reading to cover, and to try and do 2 weeks of reading, 2 weeks of rundown, and combine it with you know the first half of the show, which was already massively long, would just be a bridge too far, I think, for most people. So to help you know conserve length a little bit, conserve some time. We're going to bump the rundown to next week. We promise you we will bring you all 3 weeks of anything noteworthy from the world of comics over the, you know, in next week's episode. And who's going to determine what's noteworthy? We will.
Absolutely. And frankly, folks, we're in a little bit of unfamiliar ground because if there's one thing we don't know about, it's length.
That's true. Lots of wit, though. And a moderate amount of wit, though. A moderate amount of wit.
Nevertheless, ladies and gentlemen, Red Bastien discussions aside, let's get on to the segment that we love to call There you have it. So where should we start out, Nick, with what we've been reading and watching?
Well, since you actually have reading for the first time in, I don't know, what feels like a calendar year, why don't you start?
All right. We want to do reading first, I'm guessing, then?
Damn it, Greg. What did I just say?
Well, quite frankly, I was waiting for it to be explained to me. I don't take hints. I don't take rumor and innuendo, Nick. I take direct statements such as, yes, we should talk about reading first.
For the love of God, start talking about the books you've read.
All right. I'm going to start us out with my number three book of the time period. And this book is Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, number 13, by Robert Venditti. And a new artist, to me anyway, V. Ken Marion. This is a really, really good issue, I thought. This was in contention for my top spot, obviously, because it made number three. Just a great little team story here with – not even a team story, but almost like if you remember the old Tales of the Green Lantern Corps books from the 80s.
Yeah.
This reminded me of one of those in that it's a standalone issue. It's not tied to any greater story or any crossover or anything like that. And it's told from the perspective of someone on the planet Zudar, which is Tomar Rey's race of people, 60 years in the future. And she is relaying – events from her childhood that we've seen play out in the pages of Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps. She relays Starro the Conqueror showing up, and she relays the subsequent invasion by Larfleeze and Brainiac, and how her parents died, and how the Green Lantern Corps came to save her. She's relating this story to her grandkids, and kind of telling them about this tale of adventure that she went through and how it influenced her life. And it's very brilliantly framed. It's such a nice change of pace from what you get in superhero comics today. It's not convoluted in any way. It works perfectly as a standalone issue today, just as it would have 10, 15, or 20 years ago. And the big reveal at the end, of course, is that this grandmother ended up becoming a Green Lantern because of the Green Lantern saving her when she was a little girl. And she and her husband go out for a flight at the end. And it's just a really just kind of mushy, nice story to wet the cleanse the palate a little bit from some of the usual stuff you get in superhero comics. Very, very enjoyable book by Mr. Venditti and company.
Yeah, when I read this all those many months ago, I knew that you would enjoy it whenever you finally got there. And I'll be damned if you didn't finally get there. So congratulations on only being about 5 months behind at this point.
You asshole.
Slap dick. Anyway, moving on to my number three book of the time period. And, oh boy, here we go. My number three book of the time period. As I told,
you
folks, I have lived a damn life in the last week, and quite frankly, I'm not at my best. I'm not ashamed to admit it. But that's neither here nor there. My number three book of the time period is Aquaman number 25, with writing from Dan Abnett and art from Stip John
Sherbajic
is what I'm going to go with for this time. Until next week when I pronounce it a completely different way. But the point of the fact of the matter is, what I'm driving at, folks, what I'm trying to tell you is, it's a damn good book. Dan Abnett's writing has always, you know, since the start of his Aquaman run, has been fantastic. We have talked on these airwaves about our love for the Abnett Aquaman, how it feels like the best thing to come along to hit the character since the Geoff Johns run. And the art's usually been pretty good. I know Scott Eaton's done some good work on it.
Brad Walker,
of course, as well. But I gotta say, as good as that art was, this Sedgwick guy is like a quantum leap forward. It is instantly. I knew nothing about this guy, but Aquaman, in the course of one issue, has become one of the most beautiful books on the stands. And the great thing about it is, Aquaman is transitioning to monthly, which means that Sedgwick is going to be the full-time artist, not an alternator. So going to be very cool to see him drawing Arthur Curry's adventures each and every week. But outside of the art, Abnett continues to craft just an amazing Aquaman tale, a new status quo for Arthur Curry set up in this issue, kind of showing you what the immediate future for the book is going to be, how it's going to be different. And I, for one, hope they kind of do a slow burn with this one here and really explore this new dynamic in Atlantis and see how it affects all our beloved characters. So, yeah, big major props for Aquaman 25.
Very, very good. Excited to catch up to that. His art has been something that's really brought me back into the fold of intro. I mean, I've been collecting Aquaman since the beginning of the run, but this has kind of got me wanting to catch up so I can get to this wonderful art. Nevertheless, let me move on to my number two issue of the time period, and that is going to be Detective Comics number 948. This is the first part of the Batwoman Begins two-parter.
Yes.
And it is by the writing team of James Tynion IV and Marguerite Bennett, and with artwork from Ben Oliver, who does both the pencils and the inks and the colors on this issue. This was the biggest surprise to me of this batch of comics that I read, because full disclosure, Detective Comics is a book that I dropped off my pull list, not because it was bad by any means. I was still enjoying it, but it wasn't a book that it was starting to lose me a little bit in terms of that must read factor for me. It was still very good, but this one really shocked me because it took a character in Batwoman who I've never really had an attachment for at all. Like, I've never really thought that she was a necessary into the mythos, and it really made me rethink that. And so it's a character I've never read her solo titles. I only had read her in crossovers and things like that. And I was like, you know, do we really need another Bat character? Could she have been better served as her own standalone thing? This kind of reframes her and repurposes her in a way that I find really interesting. Her dynamic with her father, who instantly, to me, Colonel Kane becomes a much more sympathetic figure in these pages than he ever was in his prior appearances. And suddenly I have a different frame of reference of viewing both him and, most importantly, his daughter, Kate, and what her mission is and how her mission differs from Bruce Wayne's mission as Batman. And while I still think that there is some question as to why she would be called Batwoman, why it was important that she be called Batwoman, I think it also takes steps to address that here by showing that she had this admiration for Batman and this almost obsession with Batman for a very long time before realizing ultimately in the next issue that she needs to forge her own identity. And I thought this was terrific. I think the art is good. Certainly the figures are very good. It's a very interesting, almost painted-looking look. Not maybe up to the standards of some of the Batwoman stories of the past from J.H. Williams. And there were some little storytelling elements here and there that bugged me that didn't flow together very well. But overall, good art. I don't want to knock it. It was good art. And the writing was excellent in this. Really got me stoked to see what's next for Kate Kane. So very high recommendation for this one.
Well, as someone who's read a few issues of the Batwoman solo title, I can vouch for the writing maintaining that quality and the art taking a big step forward. So I think you should probably check that one out whenever you get the opportunity. But moving on to my number two book of the time period, and this is the thing that comes every couple of weeks when it's time for me to praise something Marvel's doing that a lot of people hate, because my number two book of the time period is Secret Empire number 5 with Nick Spencer once again providing the words, and Andrea Sorrentino, Rod Rice, and Joshua Cassara providing the art. This kind of pulls back the lens a little bit, so to speak, by widening the scope and showing you what's going on in these different pockets of the Marvel Universe and how they are all responding to the events of the book thus far. And while also moving forward the basic plot line of Tony's band of the Resistance up against Steve's Hydra-led forces. And several characters throughout the story have made the point of, you know, Tony, the last time we backed you in a fight against Steve, we came out on the wrong side. So why should we trust you again here? And so it's just a lot of good callbacks to the last 10 years or so of Marvel continuity. Good cameos from characters like Black Panther. Got to finally get a little bit of explanation as to why Thor Odinson, a.k.a. the original Thor, is siding with Hydra Cap on this one as opposed to the Resistance. And just generally moves the plot forward in a very interesting way. Starting to also kind of reveal what I think the ultimate out of the story is going to be. And it's unique. I think there is something to say that if it turns out exactly as I'm expecting, it could be a little bit of a cop-out, but I suppose that's not unlike a lot of Marvel events of the last 10 years. But all that being said, the main reason this one finds its way into my top three, as it does anytime this guy draws a book, it seems like, that Andrea Sorrentino art continues to amaze every damn time I see it. So for those of you who, even if you were skeptical about the concept of Secret Empire, I can't say that you need to go out and drop, you know, however much it would cost you to catch up at this point on the single issues, but at the very least, whenever the trade comes out in a few months, give it a look. You might be surprised at what you find.
Love that Sorrentino.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
Let me move on to my number one issue of the time period, Detective Comics number 949. The second and final part of the Batwoman Begins two-parter by the same creative team as 948, Tynion the Fourth, Bennett, and Oliver. This took the premise that was set up by the first issue and drove it home with an RBI. And it does that in a number of ways. Number one, by progressing the flashback between Kate and her dad, and also showing her very first encounter with the Batman, which I thought was a great, great scene that established him as sort of this ultimate badass that knows when he's being watched, but then also panned back to reveal that even when he thought he was onto what was going on, he was still being watched secretly by Colonel Kane. So even Batman doesn't have all the answers, and it did a great job of setting up some of the differences between Kate and Bruce. His aversion to guns, which she doesn't share. Some of the things about him that don't match her vision for the ultimate mission. And it shows how over the course of time she grows to realize that she doesn't really want to be exactly like her dad or exactly like Batman. She wants to be her own distinct individual. Does a great job of that. It also progresses this this character, Simon, who is playing the ultimate assassin from this this group of Colonel Kane's. And they really play him up as just an arrogant jackass heel. And much to my surprise, he really gets his comeuppance in this issue. He gets the living crap beaten out of him by Batwoman and has to inject himself with the dreaded Monster Men serum to escape, which I could have.
Oh, no.
I could take or leave the whole Monster Men serum inclusion, and I'd prefer to leave it, honestly. But other than that, that was the one thing that bugged me. But even that was, I thought, well utilized in here. And the relationship between Kate and her father is one of the most interesting new dynamics in the Rebirth Initiative that's kind of flown under the radar. So really interesting stuff here. Good writing, solid art. And really excited to see what happens in the Batwoman solo title. This was good stuff, Nick.
Absolutely, I'm glad to hear that you enjoyed it. And again, I think you will enjoy that Batwoman solo book if and when you get a chance to check it out. But moving on to my number one book of the time period, and this is a book I know you're going to be you have suddenly found a newfound interest in after dropping it from your pull list like the rat bastard that you are. My number one book of the time period is Batman number 25. This is part one of the War of Jokes and Riddles, a flashback to almost like a year two type of story where it takes place about a year after the events of Scott Snyder's Zero Year that we saw, you know, several years back.
Mm-hmm.
And it also picks up via a framing sequence, a present-day framing sequence, the fallout from Batman's proposals of marriage to Catwoman, where he's talking about how he has to tell her this story that he's never told anyone, that there's something about him she has to know before they can go forward with whatever they're going to do. And while this one is drawn beautifully by Mikael Janin and Tom King writes all the characters fairly well, the reason this one finds its way into my number one spot over such high-quality books, because this was a hellacious task of picking out just three out of this massive crop of books I read over the last 2 weeks. Instantly, in one issue, for my money, I think Tom King is one of the best Riddler writers I've ever read. The way he writes Nygma in normal speech and transitioning seamlessly into the riddles, and the way he already seems to have nailed down exactly why the Riddler can be a physical threat to Gotham is brilliant, in my opinion. The breakout scene, whenever you get there, Greg, the way the Riddler escapes confinement is one of the best Riddler scenes I think I've ever read. I just absolutely loved everything that had to do with Edward Nygma in this book. I am less high on Tom King's writing of the Joker But
yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
I am willing to give it a shot because I understand it's supposed to be an earlier version of the Joker, a very early version of the Joker that hasn't quite become the clown prince of crime as we know and love him. So iffy on that part, but the Riddler bits alone are worth the price of admission here.
Yeah, I've only had a chance to read the preview pages, and I came away thinking much the same thing. The Riddler read awesome. The Joker read not awesome. But I wonder if part of this might be tied in to the greater rebirth mystery of the whole three Jokers
thing. Three Jokers thing, right.
There's a chance that this is a more serious Joker that is distinct from the other Jokers that we've seen?
I think it would have to be a possibility at least, although I don't know when exactly that story is going to ever get its resolution because the three Jokers thing probably wouldn't have much to do with Doomsday Clock, and yet I've heard that Geoff Johns wants to tell that story at some point, the three Jokers thing, resolve that, and I don't really know when that will be, so...
Because I've always just preferred the take on the Joker that when he becomes the Joker, he's the Joker. You know what I mean? Like, I don't like the version where he maintains the memories and he still is acting like his old self, basically, or a mob boss of some kind. And I like the idea of him being this agent of chaos from the beginning. So I don't know.
Yeah,
what do you think?
I do as well, and like I said, I am highly skeptical of this version of the Joker thus far, but I also know it's one part of what I believe is planned to be like a 7-part story, so
sure,
gonna give it a chance to see if it changes or if it improves as we go along.
Oh, sure, yeah, and I'm excited about seeing the Riddler used, because I thought the Riddler was one of the best parts of Scott Snyder's Zero Year. Really, he was the first guy, I thought, that used the Riddler well since Hush. Honestly.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, but I would also say that I think, like, while the Riddler was used consistently well throughout Zero Year, I think this one issue is more of a high point for the Riddler
than
that was. I love it, man. Love it.
Wow, looking forward to it. I guess we should do the worst and then go to quick hits. So my bottom book of the time period, this was an easy selection for me, actually. And this was actually the last comic that I read before recording this podcast. And this actually was read before I made the decision to drop the book, and it made it a little bit easier for me because this is Green Arrow number 13, which is the second part of Emerald Outlaw. This is by Ben Percy and Otto Schmidt. And there's a couple of reasons that this made my spot here, and it's not. I don't think it was a bad comic, but I think it was an exceedingly average comic. And the reason I feel that way is some of the writing in this issue is so heavy-handed that it almost comes off like a parody of the Denny O'Neil era of Green Arrow in terms of it's written – the dialogue is written as if it would be in a 70s comic at times. And – I just thought it was really on-the-nose writing, very little in the way of subtlety, character nuance. The other thing that hurts this, and I got to be honest, Nick, you know, for a long time I kind of resisted saying that I would prefer Juan Ferreira's art over Otto Schmidt's. I think Otto has taken a bit of a step back, judging by this issue anyway, and the preceding issue as well. Like, I love the way he draws Black Canary. I think he draws probably my favorite Black Canary. But, man, I really don't like the way some of these pages look, like the way they flow together. It just creates this disjointed feel because the panels don't necessarily flow the way that a Green Arrow comic is supposed to flow. there's just some scenes here, some action scenes that don't look good, that don't progress the way they would. And then in particular, Henry, here's a line of dialogue that I wanted to bring up as being particularly extraneous and expository, if you will. Henry Fife, or Fife, or however you pronounce his name, is talking to Ollie and Diggle and Dinah, and he says, "Before you start, I've got my own laundry list of complaints. I'm an indoorsman, Ollie. I'm good with computers. My hobbies are snacking and video games. I don't like bugs, and I don't like splinters, and I don't like making all these stupid arrows." That could have been a good line of dialogue if you hadn't basically had him explain to the audience what his character is.
Yeah.
That's such an outdated thing to do, in my opinion. Which is, it works fine in 80s comics or 70s comics, not so much today. So that's why this got my bottom book. It was, I like Ben Percy, and I've liked his Green Arrow run, but this feels like a lull, this storyline in particular.
So remind me what storyline this is exactly, because I don't keep up with the issue numbers very well in my head.
This is the Emerald Outlaw story, where there's a killer who is impersonating Green Arrow that's killing prominent figures who criticize Green Arrow, which is a good idea. It's a good plot. But the execution in the two issues I've read has been kind of lackluster, in my opinion.
Huh. Interesting to hear that, because I really enjoyed that storyline. But I will agree that I believe that, you know, and for my money anyway, Juan Ferreira has kind of overtaken Otto Schmidt as the premier Green Arrow artist of our time right now, just because, to me, Otto Schmidt, I always felt like the way he drew faces kind of had like this overly angular quality to it that doesn't really fit sometimes, and it doesn't really look like like a normal human face. So it's a weird thing.
It's more noticeable with the male characters than with Dinah. Like, I love the way he draws Dinah, but it's everyone else in particular. Diggle and Henry and all of the side characters that aren't any of the main characters. It just creates kind of a disjointed feel for me.
Right. Moving on to my bottom book of the week, I've got, or bottom book of the time period, since it's 2 weeks, I've got Action Comics 982. This is the latest installment in the Revenge storyline, where the Superman Revenge Squad has finally come together, those characters being, oh man, and I might forget some here, it's Cyborg Superman, Metallo, Mongol, General Zod, Blank, and the Eradicator. I think that's it. I think that's all of them. Maybe I missed some. I don't know. Point being, after the events of the previous issue, Clark has actually lost the ability to see and any sight-related superpowers he may have, which is fine and well enough. But then they close the book with like a six-page action sequence that is something like the comic book equivalent of the Jake the Snake Roberts and Rick Martel blindfold match from WrestleMania 7, where he's just literally trying, like, stumbling around trying to wait for one of them to say something so he can fly in that direction. Not my favorite concept for a Superman action scene. So while the rest of the book was fine, the last six pages dragged it down for me pretty immensely. Plus, down with Zod, down with the Cyborg Superman, but not really a big fan of this version of Mongol. Overly generic, in my opinion. Don't have a clue who the character of Blank is, and this version of Metallo has been given nothing to do of note on the squad. So, a decent book, but Action Comics takes home my bottom book of the week.
Very good. Let's move on to the quick hits here. Mm-hmm. My one quick hit that I have, I believe, is Green Arrow number 12, which is the first part of Emerald Outlaw. I kind of said my piece about this story before, but I wanted to give to kind of walk that back a little bit. This is the first issue in the story, and I thought this was actually quite a bit better than part two. This has, again, not a whole lot going on in it, but it does have some better dialogue, better characterizations, I felt. An interesting framing device with a newscast being used to frame the issue, not unlike Dark Knight Returns. A little heavy-handed at times, but the art's a little bit better in this one, I thought. So this was solid. This was a solid issue.
Good to hear. Moving on to my metric ton of quick hits, I will burn through these as quickly as I possibly can. Wonder Woman 25 brings an end, for now anyway, to the time of Greg Rucka as the writer of this title, and to the time of Liam Sharp and Bequise Evely as the artists on this title. And it mainly is telling a little interlude story, I should describe it. I think really the main stories that were being told in The Truth, The Lies, and God Watch all kind of wrapped up with issue 24. And this is kind of one just giving you, showing you actually how Wonder Woman is dealing with the fallout of that and how it has affected her personally, and giving her a little bit of happiness too, which is important to see after, you know, more than two dozen issues of pretty trying times for the character. So I enjoyed this one. Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps 23 continues the Fracture storyline, involving one of Greg's favorite characters, Bolfunga the Unrelenting. moves the plot here forward. I am very intrigued by the direction they're taking it. All the main plot is working for me, and the subplots are working for me. This book continues to be on fire. The Defenders, number two. Big step up from number one, in my opinion. David Marquez on art. I don't know what was going on with issue one, if he was in a hurry to get it out or what happened, but I actually think the book comes off a lot better in issue two. And I think Bendis does a better job of juggling all the different characters and giving them each a moment to shine here. Particularly loved Jessica Jones and Luke Cage's interactions in this one, given all the events that have been happening to them over in the pages of Jessica's solo title. So major props to Defenders number two. Green Arrow 25, a little one-shot called Broken Arrow that wraps up the events of the rise of Star City and kind of casts us forward into the hard-traveling hero storyline that is coming up in the coming months. And just a good book. Otto Schmidt on art, but I actually enjoyed his art for the most part here. So not a whole lot to say on that one.
At any point, does John Travolta show up with a train?
Sadly, no. I wish he had. The Mighty Thor number 20 continues Jason Aaron's outstanding run on the title. Features the debut of the War Thor, who now possesses the ultimate Mjolnir. That's right, we got three Thors running around the Marvel Universe. And while I was not excited about the concept of introducing a third Thor, once they reveal the origin here and the reasoning for why it happens, I'm actually kind of okay with it, especially because it is clear it's only going to be a short-term thing. I would not expect this character to have a hammer long-term.
How many Mjolnirs are there now?
Two Mjolnirs and one Yarnbjorn.
God, that sounds like a story waiting to be told around the old campfire.
Well, you know, they should have...
Two Mjolnirs and a Yarnbjorn.
They should get all the... all the Thors together, Greg, all the different Thors there are, and drop a Mjolnir in the middle of a bunkhouse, and we will just see what happens.
That's how they used to settle it back in the old prairie days, Nick.
And then, of course, we'll need Nelson Royal to explain to us what it is while he sits around a campfire drinking coffee. But we're going off the rails once more. Detective Comics 959 continues the Intelligent storyline. I continue to enjoy this one, mainly for the interactions between Batman and Zatanna, which is always a dynamic that I've kind of enjoyed, so big props to this one. Darth Vader number 2. Charles Soule continues to have a great grasp on writing this version of Darth Vader from this time period in his life. Not yet the calm, cool, and collected Dark Lord of the Sith we would see in the original trilogy, but still kind of transitioning from the whiny hothead that Anakin often was into the Darth Vader we all know and love. So interesting to see Soule writing him in the midst of that transition.
I will
say, however, that the art from Kamen Koley, as I'm going to call him, just because that's the only name I have for him, still not quite working for me. I think they need a different art style in this book, but the writing continues to be this good. It won't matter that much to me. Green Lanterns 25, The Return of the First Lantern. Here we see Volthoom finally put his master plan into place, and it looks for the time being like he has pretty well whipped our resident Earth Green Lantern's ass. Intrigued to see where they take this one going forward. And like I've said before, continues to almost like add more nuance to the Geoff Johns version of Volthoom, fleshes him out a lot more, and makes him a much more interesting character, in my opinion. Peter Parker, The Spectacular Spider-Man number 1, from writer Chip Zdarsky and Adam Kubert on the art. I enjoyed the hell out of this one, man. Reads a lot more like the version of Spider-Man that I know and love as compared to that fucking Dan Slott Spider-Man that we've gotten for what feels like 15 years now. If I had my druthers, and I don't, I would have Zdarsky and Kubert take over the main title ASAP.
What if you had your Sally Struthers?
Well, quite frankly, I don't think we need to discuss that on air. I'll spank it. Superman number 25 wraps up the Black Dawn storyline. I got to tell you, despite not knowing much about this Manchester Black character, I kind of dig him. He has become, for my money anyway, one of the more intriguing Superman villains that I've ever read. I like his attitude. I like everything about him. And although I will say, the ending page, the cliffhanger that this storyline ends on, might be one of the most Because Comics things I've ever read in its sheer insanity. I can't wait for you to read it and see what becomes of Manchester Black.
Mm-hmm.
All-Star Batman number 11 continues the First Ally storyline. enjoyed this one, and I'm gonna make a criticism I never thought I would make. Raphael Albuquerque kind of turns in from what I think is a little bit of a subpar performance on art in this book. Usually he is outstanding, especially in pair with Scott Snyder, but for whatever reason, this one just didn't work for me. Teen Titans number 9 kicks off the Blood of the Manta storyline, which has me extremely intrigued as they are refocusing the book for this storyline anyway onto the Aqualad, the character of Aqualad, and the mystery of his true parentage, which anybody who has seen Young Justice knows that what his true parentage is. And I am very excited by the little bits and pieces we've already seen of Black Manta in the book, and I think it's going to be a hell of a story going forward. And then finally, Star Wars Dr. Aphra number 8 wraps up the crossover between Dr. Aphra and the main title, The Screaming Citadel. Kind of rushes through the finale, in my opinion, a little bit, and kind of shows Luke pulling off some things that, in my opinion, he probably shouldn't have been capable of during the time period of being, you know, since this book is set between the events of A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, which is where he really, you know, began his formal training. I will also say the art kind of slips here, but Kieran Gillen's a fantastic writer of these characters, and again, the dynamic between Luke and Aphra is something I definitely want to see more of going forward. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is my assortment of quick hits.
Boy, we really stretched the definition of quick hits there. But I will say that that was a good summation of all those books, Nick. You kept it punchy, which is all I can ask, mm-hmm. and all anyone can ask. Let's move on to Hwachin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is interesting, Nick, because the show Preacher has come back to air.
Yes, the show Preacher, which is supposed to be really our only thing that we're going to feature in watching during the summer months. Yes, it's come back to air. But tell the people,
it's come
right?
back to air due to a – don't try to put this on me – due to a DVR malfunction.
I'm not putting the DVR malfunction on you, but continue.
I have been unable to watch Preacher.
Uh-huh.
And
what have you? What are you leaning towards doing, Greg?
Just not watching it and waiting until it comes on Hulu or Netflix to watch.
Which means you're going to wait and watch it during the fall when we already have 1,000 things to talk about, as opposed to helping us fill out our dead summertime.
Well, what am I supposed to do, Nick? Am I supposed to just start with episode 4 or whatever the hell?
Quite frankly, you know numerous friends who could get you some online access to this show if you could only get over your phobia of watching television shows and or wrestling products on a computer.
Don't like doing it. Prefer not to do it. We'll see what becomes of that. But nevertheless, I know you've been watching Preacher. So what have you thought of Preacher so far, Nick?
It's difficult to say because I don't want to spoil things for your spoiler paranoid ass. But I will say, having only seen 3 episodes, and I think they aired the 4th. I'll be honest with you, Greg. I don't remember how many episodes I've seen. So let me just offer some very generic comments. From the open, from the jump, this season to this point has felt a lot more in tone like the comic than season 1 ever approached. For my mind, anyway. There were glimpses of what the tone of it could be and what it probably should have been in season 1. But here, it almost seems like it's embracing it and it's just running in that direction. Still not doing a direct adaptation. It's picking and choosing its elements. But I will say I have greatly enjoyed what I've seen thus far, and I think the overall plot, which seems to be the Saint of Killers as a much bloodier version of the Terminator, just an unstoppable force of nature, a killing machine that is pursuing Jesse Custer to the ends of the earth, is a pretty intriguing setup for this season and how it's going to play out, which means I can't wait to see how they handle the character once we eventually reach the point, if we reach the point of what came in the comics with the bargain between Jesse and the Saint. So, very much enjoying it. Cassidy continues to steal almost every scene he's in. And even Tulip has not been an unbearable bitch this season. So,
that's good.
I'd say big improvements all around for my money.
Good to hear, Nick. I look forward to watching it one day. Nevertheless, I too have been watching something. And what I've been watching is I watched the entirety because, as some of you, many of you, most of you know, I do not have a PlayStation 4 console. So I am and I am unlikely to be able to get one anytime in the near future, barring a flight of fancy on my part. However, because of that, I could not wait to view the story mode of Injustice 2, which is, frankly, my primary reason for being interested in that game since I suck so bad at fighting games. So, I went on YouTube and I found the full movie of the game's cutscenes, and I watched the two, it was about 2 hours and 30 minutes, give or take, and really enjoyed it. Thought it was excellent. Great story for this Injustice 2 game. They had a great usage of Brainiac. They really make Brainiac feel like a huge top-level threat, which he should be, in my opinion. And they continued some of the threads of the first game. They paid off, actually, some of the character paths of the first game. We get to see Hal Jordan go on a path of redemption, which I thought was really cool. We get to see Green Arrow and Black Canary, although I think the argument could be made that they should have been featured more than they were, but what we got of them was excellent. It was right out of the comics that you're reading right now from Ben Percy. Really great dynamic between those two. And we got to see some more phenomenal voice work from Kevin Conroy as Batman, from really the whole cast of characters. Robin was great. Superman was great. Catwoman was good. Harley was really good. Much better version of Harley than we've gotten in the trailers for this upcoming animated movie. So as far as voice goes. So really, really good stuff. I think if I had to lodge some complaints, it would be minor stuff like I think the Superman thread was resolved a little quickly for my taste. If you do the Batman ending, there's two different endings to the game. I thought the Superman ending was good. The Batman ending I thought was a little too abrupt for my taste. I thought it ended really quickly. And then the other thing is a little bit bigger of a deal, I think, and it's that the one character that I think this franchise gets really, really wrong is Wonder Woman.
Agreed.
Like,
yeah.
I really don't like this because she...
It's almost they took the Infinite Crisis version of Wonder Woman and then just ran down... Geoff Johns had kind of started her, moving her down this path and then showed how she came back from that path, mm-hmm. Through the events of Infinite Crisis. It's almost like the writers of Injustice just took that path and just sprinted down it, at 100 miles an hour. And that's the direction they're going. Like, hyper-aggressive to the point of discomfort oftentimes.
And they even address this in the game without outright confronting it yes or no. But it almost comes off as if she is one of the main reasons that Clark goes over the edge because of her influence on Kal-El. She's actively encouraging him to go down this path of madness. And that didn't sit well with me. Everything else was awesome. I thought it was great. Batman was phenomenal. The way that they portrayed his facial expressions, the vocal work from Kevin Conroy, the way that they showed him struggling with his emotions throughout this, and that you always got the impression that even though he had to plan for a contingency, he really truly was hoping that this was going to work out, that he was going to get through to Clark and get his friend back that he truly missed. I thought it was excellent. And of course the Supergirl plot, who ends up being kind of the main character of the game in some ways, was tremendous. So I really enjoyed this one, Nick.
Absolutely. I'm glad to hear it. Glad to hear that you enjoyed it. Although I will say, as much as I enjoyed it as well, I still kind of prefer the story mode from the first game. To me, I think the Superman Batman divide is kind of told a little bit better in that first one. Here they kind of have Brainiac as the villain for a lot of it and then kind of hotshot it, so to speak, right there at the very end. I think the first one kind of holds together more cohesively, but I enjoy them both.
Yeah, both great. It's hard for me to say which one I liked better than the other. I think both of them did certain things better than the other, but both great, and certainly hoping that this franchise continues into the future, hopefully Mortal Kombat DLCs.
Yeah. Good lord, that is your one when it comes to this franchise. That Mortal Kombat DLC just got you fired up.
I'm not fired up.
You bring it up a disproportionate amount, I'll put it that way.
As opposed to bring, I mean, like,
as opposed to most people who talk about the game online, you're one of your main points of contention every time you criticize the game. You bring up the Mortal Kombat DLC.
Kind of like how you're incapable of talking about Spider-Man without criticizing Dan Slott.
That's a great point. Mortal Kombat DLC is your Dan Slott.
I don't hate it to near the degree that you hate Dan Slott.
I hope that the Mortal Kombat DLC starts, you know, being passive aggressive to everyone on Twitter. That would be awesome. I don't know how it would be possible, but it would be awesome.
Well, you know, you can never be too sure. We could even arrange that, bro. We could create Twitter accounts for the Mortal Kombat DLC characters.
Right. That would be awesome. We should do that.
Nevertheless, what were you going to say, Nick? Did you have anything else to add?
I don't remember.
In any event, that's all that I've been watching that's comic book related, other than the aforementioned Iron Man 3.
Hey, since you're not going to watch Preacher until the season's over, you should finally watch Luke Cage and or Iron Fist, so we can talk about Defenders whenever that happens in August.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea, Nick. That's not a bad idea at all. Not a bad idea. I should do that.
Especially considering we have an episode of Countdown coming up in August. It's supposed to count down the top 5 Marvel Netflix episodes.
Oh, God. From what you've told me, there's no point in even watching Iron Fist because nothing will be on there. So.
No. I want you to watch Iron Fist. I want you to watch Iron Fist, Greg, because when all of us were so excited about Luke Cage and Jessica Jones and Daredevil, you were like,
sure.
I don't know. I think Iron Fist is going to be the best, you know, the best of all of them.
And it should have been. Well, neither was Luke Cage, from what I understand.
Luke Cage was all right.
It wasn't the best, was it?
It was the Garner. No, because everything must be the best or the worst.
Or the worst. Right.
Jessica Jones is the best, which means both seasons of Daredevil, Luke Cage, and Iron Fist are all the worst.
All the worst, right. You're either first or you're last.
If you ain't first, you're last. Yep.
Yep. Quite frankly.
Wisdom
now,
from Ricky Bobby.
With all that being said, folks, that brings an end to an edition of reading and watching, although it doesn't bring an end to Nick being a contentious douche. So we'll continue that into next week and all further episodes.
Let me tell you something. Again, I have lived a life in the last week. You don't want to know the shit I've seen and what I've been through, so don't come here to me with your complaints of me being
a contentious
douche. You may know a couple. You might know a couple, but you don't know the full story. You don't know all the ins, all the outs, all the what have yous.
Yeah, lemon panties, giggle panties.
That was some damn. Never mind. Let's. Yep. Woo.
Whisker biscuit. Some bitch.
Let me just put it to you like this: if you had to spend 5 days alone with Cousin Eddie, you wouldn't be happy either.
I don't know. I like Cousin Eddie.
You like Cousin Eddie for 15 minutes in the fucking vacation movies. You don't like him for...
Throwed it away, Nick.
They took it and they threw it away. Songs about words.
Ah, we're off topic. Ladies and gentlemen, please let us know your thoughts on the comics that we discussed here. Tweet us, as I mentioned, I think, earlier in the broadcast, but... just in case. It was a long 90 seconds or whatever. So at GPhillips8652, he is at NickDuke87. Jim Ross is at JRsBBQ. And, of course, you can email us, GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com, NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com.
Oh, and don't forget about
emails right now, so please do your part in dispersing those.
Don't forget about Jim Barnett at Ahmha.
Yes, that's good. Nevertheless, all that good stuff. Facebook.com, Place to Be Nation Comics is the page.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The big announcement.
That thing.
Yeah. PlaceToBeNation.com has undergone a bit of an overhaul, as you've noticed if you visited the site to find this podcast. We now have a commenting function through Discus. If you go online and you sign up for a Discus account, it's very simple. You can just tie it into your Facebook. It's just like Facebook commenting. you go on there and do real-time commenting, interact with fans of the various podcasts. A lot of good wrestling discussion goes on there, but we like to get some comics discussion going as well. So you've got no excuse, if you're listening to this show, to not let us know what you think. Hit us up on any of the aforementioned avenues, and we're always up for that. Now, Nick, what do we got going their way in the coming weeks?
Yeah, so next week we're going to be back with a very special installment of the Long Book Hunters. You may remember a couple of months ago that we reached for some low-hanging fruit by providing you with a long book hunt on the hard-traveling heroes, which, of course, we derived our name for, you know, the hard-traveling fanboys. But we're going to reach for some low-hanging fruit once again as we do a long book hunt on the Longbow Hunters, the seminal Mike Grell three prestige issue Green Arrow story that kind of redefined the Green Arrow for the age of the 1980s and 90s, launched Mike Grell onto a legendary 80-issue run with the character, what is still widely considered to be one of the greatest times in the character's history. So that's what we're going to have on tap for you there. And then we're going to close out the month of July, and we're going to close it out, Greg. Actually, no, excuse me. I skipped something. I'm sorry. So, yep. Nope. Yep. I got it. Sorry. So, after the longbow hunt, or the longbook hunt, on the longbow hunt, we're going to have a very special edition of Off the Page where we're going to get together with some of our mutual friends, the aforementioned Russell Sellers, the aforementioned Andrew Chandler Frazier Garner the 17th, and we're going to get together to play a little bit of the DC Comics deck building game. If you haven't heard of this, don't worry. You're not alone. Most people haven't. It's an extremely nerdy card game featuring the characters of DC Comics, and we're going to kind of play a couple hands of the game and hopefully probably even record a little mini review of the game as we are playing around when we see each other. So that's going to be our Off the Page this month, and then we're going to wrap up the month of July with a countdown of our top five retcons in comics history, which should certainly be some interesting ground. Tons of retcons over the years, so should make for some variety in our lists.
Now, Nick, who is your favorite low-hanging fruit, and why is it Tom Zink?
Well, actually, my favorite low-hanging fruit is Alex Wright, so.
Oh, I see. Well, with all that being said, folks, we've come to the end of another journey. Again, no rundown this week. We will hit that up next week and try to get you all the news and notes from around the comic book world. Until then, until next week, I can leave you only with these words of wisdom. I'd rather fight a man than love a woman. See you next week.
Got your weekly segments coming to your town.
Reading, watching, and the rundown.
It's the greatest show on Face to the Nation.
Certainly a unique situation.
Ooh,
High Traveling Fanboys.
High Traveling Fanboys. High Traveling Fanboys. I travel fanboys.
Bill told me that if he ever came across a woman who was extremely clean and well-kept, he would tell her to put on a pair of sweatpants and a sweatshirt, go take a 2-mile jog, and then come back and see him when she was done.